Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this joint meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules, meeting an informational hearing with the House Committee on Rules.
I'll call to order the House Committee on Rules for Wednesday, March 27.
And the topic of this informational hearing is Senate Bill 822. I just wanted to explain to members of the audience a little bit about how we're going to operate. We have on our agenda invited testimony first. That is very limited invited testimony, starting with the co-sponsors of the bill, and I see they're already seated at the witness table. They're going to be followed by the representatives of the public employee retirement system, and then after that, we will be going into our public testimony. Under the public testimony, people will be limited to 3 minutes apiece. We really want to hear from as many members of the public as possible today. I know that we do have a couple of legislators in the room, and our protocol here is to allow legislators to testify, but we're hoping that they won't keep the public from speaking. I also want to just say that I'm well aware that this is a topic that is of great importance to members of the audience, members of the public, and we're hoping that people can keep their comments respectful and civil. We understand that there is a lot of strong feeling and passion on all sides of this issue. We're looking to hear from as many people as possible and do that in a civil and respectful way. And Representative Garrett, did you have anything to add before we start off?
I do not. Thank you for those comments. We're ready to go.
Okay, great. Well, we will just start right off then with Senator Buckley, with Senator Devlin and Representative Buckley, whichever of you has decided to go first. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time and consideration today. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I'm proud to be here today with my co-chair in Ways and Means, Senator Richard Devlin. Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'm going to take a few minutes to give a background for this bill. How did this bill come about, and how does it fit into the co-chair's budget that's presented? Because I believe it needs to be seen in context with the budget we're trying to pass in this session. My dad, Madam Chair, when he raised us, there are five of us kids, his constant refrain to us is that you're only as good as your word. Keep your word. Keep your word. It's a constant thing that we're brought up with. The budget challenge that we face in 2013, coming out of the Great Recession, is that we have two promises in front of us. We've given our word as a state in two different directions, and we can't keep both of those promises. We've promised retirees and workers a certain benefit package that they've worked for, many of them for decades. We've promised our kids educational opportunities at least as good as the ones that we had when we were growing up. Two promises that as we entered into this budget process, first taking the governor's recommended budget and then taking that budget apart to see how we could put it together for the co-chair's budget, became very clear to us during this process we could not keep both those promises. Now, those who have come into this session believing that the highest priority must be changing PERS, changing the commitments that we made in PERS in order to stabilize the PERS system, in order to hold down costs for employers, and that's an absolutely valid point of view. My co-chair and I have taken the position in consultation with many of the members of this body that the highest priority actually is stabilizing our education system. Our K-12 system must be our first priority as we come out of this Great Recession. We have heard from districts, we've heard from teachers, we've heard from families, we've heard from students around the state that our state cannot stand any more teacher layoffs. Our state cannot stand additional days cut from the school year. So our first and primary priority for our budget was to get to a funding level for K-12 that would give most, not all, but most districts in our state the chance to stabilize, the chance to end the teacher layoffs, and the chance to provide opportunities for our kids again that they richly deserve and that we have promised them. That is the framework of the budget that we proposed. After making that decision and working towards what we had to get to, we met with every organization involved with education. We met with the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Board Association. We met with the School Administrator Association. And consistently, the number they came up with for us was $6.75 billion. Consistently, we were told from every organization that that was the number that we needed to reach in order to help stabilize our K-12 system. And Senator Devlin and I set out to try to build our budget around that number. How do we get that number? As everyone can see, the increase in PERS costs were a major challenge to getting that number. So again, working on that principle that we were going to reach that number, we were going to do our best to stabilize K-12, we had to look at what we could also do to stabilize the PERS system, and at what level could we change the promise that we made to retirees and workers, since we could see no other way to get that level without changing that promise. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, when people talk about PERS reform, I constantly ask them to go back and talk about PERS retirees and PERS workers. We are talking about changing people's lives, their retirement benefits that they have counted on. We're talking about changing things that they have worked for years. I believe this, Madam Co-Chair, is a state responsibility, not a PERS responsibility, to stabilize the system and to find the way to move our state forward again. All of us have benefited by the lower salaries that were paid to state workers for decades. All of us have. Every school board member, every school board has benefited by teachers receiving lower salaries for decades now in exchange for the promise of a pension they could count on. We are changing that equation with this proposal. So again, when people talk about PERS reform, I hope they'll take it as we're talking about PERS changes on retirees and on workers. So the question we wrestled with for many, many weeks is how do we change our promise? How do we go back on the promise that we made? The need to do so was very clear to us. So the next question that we faced was, how do we do this in a way that minimizes the impacts to those retirees and those workers? How do we do it in a way that is the most fair, that has the least amount of impact to those people who have dedicated their lives to our kids, our schools, and our communities? How do you do this in a way that, even though if you don't think it is a fair thing to do, how do you do it in a way that does the least amount of damage, and how do you do it in a way that might be seen as legal, given the various court cases that have been decided upon on this issue? We came up with several proposals revolving around the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, given that 68% of the current PERS finances lean towards the 68% of retirees that are receiving the benefits. And the COLA became the area that we focused on as a way to make an adjustment, hopefully to make it in a way that has a small enough impact but also realizes the savings necessary. It needs to be pointed out that the PERS reforms of 2003 were working, and I salute the members of this legislature who had to go through that process and to put those reforms in place. The system was fully funded in 2007 before the Wall Street crash. Not a single PERS retiree, not a single public worker was responsible for the Wall Street crash. And again, I believe since as a state we have benefited from their services for decades, it is not right for us to ask them to be the only people to address the challenge now given to us by the Wall Street crash and the impacts of the Great Recession. So that's the framework we worked in, Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, of how to develop a plan that would ask for a contribution from PERS retirees and future retirees, that would ask patience from all of us as we move into the next 2 to 4 to 6 years and work to try to stabilize the system, to address the $16 billion unfunded liability, which is now down to $14 billion given the return on investments we've experienced this year, to see what next year's return on investments are, and to do this in a way, again, that is the least damaging to retirees, has the best chance to be upheld in court, and gives a chance to work towards solving the PERS challenge, not in one fell swoop, not in a campaign to reform a system, but as a way to balance a budget and pay for education, pay for needed state services in a way that is the most fair as we could come across. And with that, I'll turn it over to my co-chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committee,
I'm Senator Richard Devlin from Senate District 19, Lower Southwest Portland, including the community of Dunthorpe, Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, Stafford Basin, my claim to being a rural legislator, and two small communities of Burning River Grove. I am not really here today because I want to be, but because I need to be. And I'm very pleased to be here with my colleague, Representative Buckley, the co-chair of Ways and Means, the House co-chair. You are sitting in the room where Ways and Means normally meets, the 26 members of Ways and Means. In addition to that, there are 10 more members that are not full members but serve on our subcommittees, so more than a third of the legislature. I know each one of them and each legislator takes their responsibility to the people of this state very seriously. And I know each one of them actually appreciates the hard work that public employees do and have done. And they understand the implications that some of the changes that we will need to make may have on retirees and may have on current employees when they retire in the future. But I would not be here unless I felt this was necessary. And I can say that very emphatically. But we are at a juncture right now, both within the state in terms of meeting the basic requirements of our people, whether it be in the classroom, whether it be protecting them in their home and community, or whether it be protecting the most vulnerable, that we may have to make a lot of difficult choices. This is not the 2003 discussion. It is not, I want to stress that four or five times over, it is not the 2003 discussion. Many of the reforms of 2003, whether you felt they were fair or unfair, have had the result that people anticipated. There is only a very small number of people, and these are people typically now that have more than 30 years of service, that are retiring at 100%. Actually, I think about 4.5% of retirees. The actual average retiree is actually retiring at a lower percentage of final average salary than they did even before the bump in retirement that occurred in the late 1990s and early 2000s. The money match retirees on average now retire, if they have more than 30 years of service, at 74% and will be coming down gradually. The system was fully funded in 2007. We would not be here today having this discussion. In fact, there is a limited chance that we may have been even here discussing future rates that would not be increasing. They would have at least been stable. But what happened in 2008 is not the people's responsibility that's behind me. It's not the people's responsibility that are in front of me. It's what basically happened. And sometimes when things happen in life, you have to deal with what happens in life and make decisions however hard they may be to make. This is a hard decision. Now, we lost $17 billion of the assets of the PERS system in 2008. Wait, it's a little bit more money than we even normally talk about, $17 billion. What was that $17 billion? It was 27% of the entire assets of the system, the entire assets that had accrued since its very beginning of its existence. Some people will say, well, the economy will just pick up and that will solve the problem. Well, that may have solved a minor downturn sometime in the past. Probably would have solved the downturn we had in 2003 to some extent. But this is so severe that the economy improving alone will not solve it. Plus, we are facing a lot of additional challenges that we've never talked about before. We have approximately about 70,000 people in this state within the PERS system that are eligible to retire right now. Oh, about 120,000 that are retired, and about over 300,000 people that are either retired, active, or inactive in the system. These are going to be difficult changes to make. But how we approached this was not because we wanted to do it, and it's not because we wanted to say anything about the good work that our public employees have done or that our former public employees as retirees have done. It's because we need to act, and we need to act now. We knew that this was coming last year. particularly given the sharp increase in PERS rates for employers in the 2011 biennium. So I think our discussions between Representative Buckley and I, although neither one of us could presume we'd be in the same positions, because you still have to go through an election to be in the same position, you still have to get an appointment by your presiding officer to have the same position. We knew that this was coming. Personally, I and my staff have worked since about last February, looking at every option for PERS, looking at every potential change you could make, looking at what the future was in terms of what the earnings potential might be, and trying to determine what the best course of action was. I think we both applauded our governor for his courage when he released his budget, and he included within his budget the issue that there did have to be some change in the PERS system. Also probably applauded that we do need to do some things to curtail some of our costs in public safety. But we didn't just take the governor's proposal. We looked at all proposals that are out there as they came forward. But in the end, we settled on similar proposals to the governor, but not the same. Now let me underline that. Similar, but not the same. Now, we do have the proposal in there for retirees that are out of state, which you almost find in every single proposal that you see within this building. When that was enacted some years ago, it was enacted under a belief that because of some court decisions and PERS benefits becoming taxable, that there should be some additional benefit to retirees because they would have to pay Oregon income taxes. Obviously, that is not the case in all cases. A number of retirees have moved out of state. And while you can debate that issue a long time, and I think there's some legitimate debate within that issue, we decided in the recent past, for prospectively, to no longer have that benefit for a retiree that moved out of state. And this basic measure will do that retroactively for retirees that are in state. So then we begin to look at the COLA. And some people will ask, well, why didn't you adopt or propose the governor's COLA? And I'll be quite frank. While we congratulate the governor on his courage, we didn't believe the COLA was equitable or that it would ultimately be upheld in court. And let me explain that. The governor's COLA, this is a little bit higher than the average retiree, but it's a fairly simple equation to understand. The governor's COLA was for $24,000 in income, you would receive 2%. Now, if you're a $48,000 retiree, what that means immediately is your COLA has went to 1% if you're a $48,000 retiree, because you're only getting a COLA on the first $24,000. It also means over the period of time that that COLA is in existence, the amount that that COLA will provide as a percentage of your retirement is going to decline year after year. And you ask, why is that the case? Well, the reason that is the case is because the COLA amount, the income it's based on, is not indexed. I asked this to Mr. Cleary when he was trying to explain the governor's proposal. I said, well, so the $24,000 is indexed. No. So when the employee gets the COLA on the first $24,000, and so they get $480,000, and that's $24,480, then the COLA is based on the $24,480. No. It's based on the $24,000. It's $480 for that employee for every year, for the next 10, the next 20, the next 30, whatever. So it's a significantly reduced COLA, and it's diminishing in value over time. Now, because it's doing all those things, it has a huge savings, an immense savings, $810 million. $810 million, a lot of money. $810 million in this biennium and similar dollars out in the future. But to try to propose a COLA that you believe is equitable and also has a chance before the courts, it's very hard to get anywhere close to $810 million. Let me give you a couple of examples. Those of you that have read some of the PERS documents will see the COLA proposal for $32,000. $32,000? And $24,000, not much difference, except it's next, is $570 million. Many of you know that Representative Hanna has put forward a proposal. His is at $36,000, $510 million in savings. We have been told within all of our discussions with attorneys, both outside the building and inside the building, and particularly with the Attorney General's office and with Legislative Council, that there are a couple of things we want to do. One, we probably should go to an area of the law in the COA that hasn't been tested in the court yet. I'm not an attorney. But the court, when they acted on the COA in previous cases, acted on section one of the section that says employees should basically have a COA. They did not act on section two, saying how that COA was described. Also, particularly from the Attorney General's office, we've been told that it would be better if a COA applied over the entire amount of a retirement rather than simply over a portion of it. Obviously, the difference between a cap and a graduated COA. So we have actually went to a graduated COLA. Now, we didn't go there and say, let's get us a graduated COLA. Let's ask PERS to get us a graduated COLA, and we'll just put that on the table. I think we've spent more than probably a month. We've probably done, and Mr. Cleary, I think, will tell you, we've probably done more than 15 different options for a COLA, probably more than that informally. Not just looking at what the COLA would save, but what the COLA would do. Meaning, what would its impact be on actual people, real people, which is what Oregonians are, whether they're retirees or not, whether they're public employees or not. These things impact real people. So we looked at what the impact would be. So after much deliberation and looking at all the different types of COLA arrangements, we came up with a COLA, and I'm supposed to be here to explain what I believe is simple, but some people believe it's not. So I'll try. The COLA basically will apply to all retirement income. For the first $20,000 of retirement income that a retiree receives, they will receive a 2% COLA, their existing COLA on that. For the next $20,000, and let me say next again, because these are marginal rates. So if you're a $40,000 retiree, if you're making $40,000, you will get 2% on the first $20,000, and you will get 1.5% on the next $20,000. Your effective rate will be 1.75%. Now let's say if you go another $20,000 beyond that, from $40,000 to $60,000. From $40,000 to $60,000, you will get 1%, but you will have received 2% on the first $20,000, 1.5% on the second $20,000, and 1% on the third $20,000, an overall effective rate of 1.5%. Beyond that, though, to make this graduated and still have the substantial savings that we believe that we need, which is the savings of $400 million, beyond $60,000, it will drop to 0.25%. So while the first $60,000 is very symmetrical, relatively easy to understand, it starts to lose its symmetry after that. I won't go much farther than this, but a $100,000 retiree will receive the equivalent of a 1% COLA. And of course, be above that, it will not be as symmetrical as below it. But let me give you an example in terms of why we chose these numbers in looking at retirees. I keep asking people a number of questions when I go into a room about what they know about PERS. One of them I ask is, what's the most common factor for the lowest income PERS retirees? About the bottom 5,000. The answer? They all receive less than $200 in retirement. If you go below 2,000, how many retirees that are retired will receive less than $2,000 per month? More than half of the PERS retirees. Contrary to Oregonian reports, how many people are retired in Oregon and actually receive more than $100,000 in retirement? I've had suggestions from people I'm talking to of 5,000, 10,000. Well, last January it was about 844. It might be up to 925 now. So we put in place our recommendation for this COLA that's contained within this bill. And this package is a package we believe the legislature should pass. We believe we'll actually put forward real savings. We believe will be the most equitable proposal that we can put forward in terms of a COLA. And we believe has the best opportunity of any COLA proposal that is being contemplated in this building to be upheld in court. I know there are people behind me that will disagree. That's part of the normal process here. But I want to go back to some of our earlier statements about the budget, about this, in a sense, contract we have. We obviously have a contract with many of the people that are here behind me who will testify in opposition to this. I think we recognize that. We also know that we don't actually determine the constitutionality of measures. The courts determine the constitutionality of measures. There are people that I have a few attorneys before me, so I'm going to be careful what I say. But, and I'm going to be very respectful here. My counsel is not Mr. Hartman, even though I respect Mr. Hartman very much. Mr. Hartman is representing his clients. My counsel is obviously not Mr. Gary, because he's representing clients. My counsel is our legislative counsel and our attorney general. And from our discussions with them, this is what I believe to be the most defensible version of a COLA that could be put before this body and have a chance to be upheld. With that, Madam Chairman, I will, and my good colleague to my right, but normally not to my right, we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. And from where we sit, Representative Buckley is to your left. So.
Okay.
So thank you for that clear explanation. And I wanted to just mention for members of the audience in the room and also people who may be listening out in cyberspace, there are on the OLIS website several items that are posted. And so you can either look at Senate Bill 822 itself, or there are items of testimony. And one of them that we just posted was a handout from Senator Devlin that actually shows these various increments of the COLA steps and some calculations about how those would play out. So that may be helpful to people if you're trying to follow this on your computer. Yes, Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, there was one thing I forgot, actually, just to say this for the record so it is in the record. The COLA proposal is a proposal I discussed. However, for the first year, because it will take some time for PERS to implement this proposal, rather than the graduated proposal that I described, it will be simply a 1.5% COLA across the board for the first year. And I believe that is described in the handout that you have.
Okay, so are there any questions for these good folks, the sponsors of Senate Bill 822? Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say, since our colleagues are here, and we're going to spend the rest of this time hearing from people who are going to criticize this plan from one direction or the other, I just want to acknowledge the work you've done. You were handed a task that no one up here would want, and I appreciate the work you've done, regardless of how we all may feel on the specifics of the proposal. You've put a lot of work and time into this, and it is much appreciated.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, gentlemen. You may not be the ones to ask this, but I'm going to put the question out so that someone will answer it. But we have heard that this proposal will, in this budget, be something in the nature of $400 million. And I would like somebody to divide that between the 2 years, because you have kind of a two-year proposal, and I would just like those numbers at some point.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I believe Mr. Cleary would be better to answer that, but we've had a lot of discussions with Mr. Cleary and PERS, and the proposal that's before you is actually $455 million, obviously including the other 55. But the belief is now is that it will generate $400 million in this biennium, and in future bienniums it will be similar amounts. Now, I just say it for the record, it's actually in the PERS documents. If you do 1.5% across the board, just simply across the board, 1.5%, In the PERS documents, it's $445 million if you just do 1.5% across the board. So the first year is about at that rate. Ours was pegged at $400 million if it was for 2 years. So for the first biennium, it could in theory be a little bit more than $400 million, but you're only going to get the credit for it for this biennium because at that level, because in the future it will be the graduated level.
Okay, I don't see any other questions, so I'll just thank you both for your hard and certainly very challenging assignment that resulted in the bill before us, and we'll let you get back to your other duties as co-chairs of Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. And next, I wanted to just, I see several legislators standing against the wall. I know that Senator Knope is here to testify. Our plan had been to go next to the agency, so are you okay waiting for that? Okay, then we will call Paul Cleary and Steve Bowman from PERS, and please introduce yourselves for the record. Go ahead and tell us what you have to tell us.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committees. I'm Paul Cleary, the Executive Director of PERS, and with me is Steve Rodman, our Deputy Director. We're pleased to be here today and just share some information on the system, put some of the context around Senate Bill 822. We had a handout. I know we've got some copies, and I believe it's loaded electronically on yours. We've got a cover memo. I would just kind of reinforce and acknowledge the difficultness of these conversations and let you know that similar conversations are going on in states around the nation. As a matter of fact, since 2009, 46 states have modified their public employee retirement systems. They generally, those modifications have generally fallen into three buckets. They modify the employee contribution. A lot of them are increasing the employee contribution, increasing the share that employees put in towards the pension. They create a new tier for new hires. Pleased to say that Oregon is way ahead of the game on that, because the tier that was created in 2003, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, is a very basic, we've described it kind of as a plain vanilla defined benefit plan that's well controlled in terms of its cost. And a number of them have modified their COLAs. As a matter of fact, 25 of the states, I think a couple of them just joined here recently, both Kentucky and New Mexico, have modified their COLAs. And of those, 14 of them have applied those modifications to their existing retirees. So just to give you a sense that this conversation is going around the nation, difficult conversation wherever it is, but it's somewhat grounded in the reality that if you share the vision that we do, that you want to have a sustainable, secure, and affordable retirement system, it quite often requires rebalancing. And this legislature has rebalanced the system twice in recent history, with the creation of Tier 2 in 1995 and with the reforms that occurred in 2003. And again, with the idea that you try to keep it sustainable, affordable, and secure. The expression, one of the representatives, maybe Representative Buckley, indicated that, you know, we're not here talking about a major PERS reform. These fall more into these cost containment category, as we describe it. No one's talking about restructuring the basic parts of the plan, like was done in 2003 with the creation of the new plan. And so in working with our board, who by statute is supposed to serve as policy advisors to the legislature on changes to PERS benefits, we suggested four different principles that ought to apply when you're looking at these cost containment measures, and they're pretty simple. Focus on the major cost drivers to generate real cost savings. Spread the burden across all affected groups, including retirees. Keep it simple. Avoid unintended consequences and enable informed retirement decisions. And the fourth is enhance the system credibility by addressing perceived inequities and abuses. Those are principles that we apply when we do our evaluation with our board. We're suggesting that, maybe those will help you as you look at the different cost containment measures that you're going to be evaluating this session as well. I want to now turn to our handouts, and these are all information that for the PERS junkies in the audience, they've seen all of this before. This is all stuff that we've shared with different audiences or had presented to our board by our actuary. The first handout is a two-pager, just a PERS facts, an overview of the system. Again, you've heard we've got about 330,000 total members, 118,000 benefit recipients, 211,000 non-retired members. That breaks down into 171,000 active and about 40,000 active. They're spread among three tiers now. I would point out that for the active member, the largest tier we have is the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. We've got more people in that tier, about 75,000, compared to about 47,000 in Tier 1 that are still working, 49,000 in Tier 2. These numbers were as of our December 31, 11 valuation, so they've changed slightly, but any growth is only going to occur in the officer plan because that's the only plan that's still open. We show you what some of our retired member averages are, and as Senator Devlin indicated, the media tends to focus on some of our outliers. Our average monthly benefit for people who retired in 2011, this is the most recent year that we've got data available for, is about $32,000. And that's equal to about 50% of the final salary. Our people at retirement today are earning generally around $64,000. So in general, it's 50%. People with 30 years are still going out primarily money match and for a number of them what's called formula plus annuity, and they're going out at a higher rate than 50%. Our average last year for people with 30 years of service was a 74% of their salary was being replaced at retirement. We would point out that in terms of our system funding, as was indicated, 2007, we were looking very good, almost 100% funded, even when we excluded the employer side accounts. That's where pension obligation bond proceeds and other lump sum payments from employers were deposited. We then took the downturn in 2008. We've been working our way back up from that. 2011 wasn't such a good year, 2.2%. But 2012 was a good year, and you can see that just in that 1 year period, we reduced our unfunded liability when we exclude the side accounts from $16.3 billion to $14 billion. Why do we exclude the side accounts? Side accounts have separate debt service on them, and you know, you got to make sure when you look at our rates. You want to look at them in both ways, both the net rate after the side account offsets and the rate before. The second page are just a couple of really key pie charts and graphs. Starting in the upper left-hand corner, that's a distribution of our monthly benefit payments. Now you'll notice we've got about 123,000 benefit payments going to 118,000 people. How's that? Well, we've got people that are receiving their own benefit. They might be a beneficiary for a spouse that preceded them. They could be have had a divorce in their history, and they've got an alternate, what we call an alternate payee benefit. So you can have one member receiving two or three different benefit payments, and we want to show you what the actual benefit payment distribution is. There you'll see about 69 or almost 70% again of those recipients, those payments are less than 3,000. If you add in the 6,000 or less, you got 95% of our payments are $6,000 a month or less. Average annual benefit using this data, about 28,000. The median, half above, half below, about 22,000. The pie chart just below this is a really key one for us. This is our accrued liabilities, and you heard the reference to the fact that we got 60% of our liabilities associated with our retirees, 8% with our inactives. 68% of our liabilities are baked in, can alter them, in terms of the benefit accumulations that have occurred for those folks. And the only thing that can affect those people is a COLA modification. If those folks are basically taken off the table, you're trying to solve this problem, this cost containment problem, on the remaining 32% of your liabilities, and that becomes extremely challenging. The two charts to the right there, these both show the success of the 2003 reforms. Those reforms were designed to freeze the money match benefits and eventually drive this system back to being a full formula retirement system, and you can see that success. As a matter of fact, this year, 2012, we've got some data on that already on the calculation trends. First year in that entire time period from 1990 and probably going way back before that full formula became the majority of our members who retired went out under full formula. Money match eventually is going to disappear in this system. You need to have 25 years or more of service in this system today in order to stand a good chance of going out as a money match benefit. And the replacement ratio trends are doing the same thing. Turning to this next chart, why are we here? This probably explains why we're here more than anything else. Our contribution rates are going up. You can see this biennium, 2011-13, 16.3% is our average, system-wide average base rate. Currently scheduled, those rates are currently scheduled to go to 21.4% starting July 1 of 2013. That's about a $900 million increase in employer cost over the biennium. And then there's another 2.3% that's collared off that will go into effect in the 15-17 biennium. So you can see eventually on this projection here, if we just earn 8%, and that's the olive colored line, we're going to get to about 25% rates, and we're going to stay there for a 20-year period. That's our amortization period. We work to get to 100% funded by the end of that amortization period. People ask us, well, what kind of rate of return would it take for you to stay at your current level, to stay at 16.3%? If we could guarantee, or if somebody would guarantee to us, that we'd have 9.25% rate of return annually for the next 20 years, we could stay at that level. If we move to the 21.4 and someone could guarantee that we'd have 8.25% return for the next 20 years, we could stay at that level. But all the consultants, and I serve as a non-voting member on the Oregon Investment Council, all of the investment consultants, our own actuaries, are all telling us you can't achieve those kind of returns going forward, and you certainly can't bank on them. And it's primarily because what's going on in the fixed income market. When you've got 30-year bonds today going for 3.2% returns, that tells you that money people are thinking that's all they're going to get over that time period for the fixed income part of your portfolio, and that's about 30% of our portfolio. So, you know, in the past, we were getting 5-6% on those bonds, so it didn't take that much for the rest of the portfolio to drag it up to 8. But if you can only bet on 3 for 30% of your portfolio, it takes a. We just don't have any predictions that we're going to make those kind of earnings going forward. So we don't believe we can earn our way out of this problem. I just wanted to share that information with you. What this chart shows is you know, if you really had great years and you earned 10.25%, that's that black line. You would start falling off. But if you only earn 4.5%, you can see where the rates go. I think it's much more reasonable to look at the 8 and 7.25 lines. That's probably better indicators of what we can anticipate long term. But it's that kind of rate that similar projections drove reforms in 95 to add Tier 2. Similar projections drove reforms in 2003. The fourth page is just a reflection of how we determine our liabilities and the role that cost of living adjustments play in those liabilities. And what you see here is the blue lines are current retired benefits, and then the blue crosshatch in that bar chart is COLAs that will be granted post-2011 to people who are currently retired. And then the buff lines, mustard lines, are non-retired benefits, and then similarly the COLA accumulations that grow on top of that. The only thing I point out, besides the trends in those charts, is that you go out 25 years, you go out to 2036, 2037, we're going to be paying $7.5 billion in benefits annually out of this system. About $2 billion of that payment will be cost of living adjustments. So you know, we figure that's more than 25%. We figure that the COLAs add somewhere between 20 and 22% to the cost of the benefit. You don't think it's much, 2%, but it's 2% compounded, and you know, every 20 years or so, that your benefit goes up by 50% at that level. The other thing I want to point out on here is the dash line. People ask us, well, when are you going to be done paying Tier 1 members' benefits? Well, you can see that in 2041, more than half of the benefits that we'll be paying will still be going to Tier 1 members and their beneficiaries. You know, we have long-term relationships with our members, and we're going to still have a long tail. Tier 1's got a long tail, and we'll still be paying a lot in that time period. The next page is just the detail on our monthly benefit payments. You heard Senator Devlin talk a little bit about you know, how we have relatively few people that are making more than $6,000 a month, and in fact only about 5%, but they do represent about 15% of our total benefit payments, total benefit dollars. So what you've got here is both the distribution in $500 increments of the number of payments that we make, and then the percent of benefits paid. So you can see that, you know, almost 70% of our benefit payments are $3,000 a month or less. They represent about 38% of the total payments that we make, and so forth. And this gives people, I think, an idea as they look at different COLA concepts, what the distributional effects of those are. The final page is, this comes from a concept analysis that we originally prepared in December. We updated in February. We'll continue to update this because it's a living document, and indeed we'll add, once we get the formal analysis on Senate Bill 822 from our actuaries, which we're hoping to have sometime before close of business tomorrow. We'll add a page that will deal just with Senate Bill 822 to this analysis. This one shows how we estimate the impacts of eliminating the out-of-state tax remedy. You recall that was this boost in benefits that was granted to offset Oregon state income taxes to certain members. Now, it only applies to people who were hired before July 14th of 1995. So it's almost most Tier 1 people, but not all. Some of us were hired after that, like in November of 1995. But it doesn't apply to anybody in Tier 2. It doesn't apply to OPCERT members. So this is only available for Tier 1 members hired before that date. And the boost varies. It comes under two different statutory provisions. One of them is based on the years of service before September 29th, 1991. One of them is based on how many years of service you have. It ranges from 2 to 9.8%. That's the boost in benefit. We figure that about 15% of our benefits go to non-Oregon residents, and on average, their benefits are boosted about 6%. So if this bill passes, we would remove on average 6% of the current payment from about 18,000 of our retired members who are non-resident to Oregon. COLA, similar provision. You know, if we had a page for the 1.5% COLA, you know, it would show about a $2.4 billion liability reduction, you know, about a 2.2% rate reduction, 2.3 or somewhere in there, and that $400 million in that range in terms of the reduction. We do have to analyze this bill as a combined bill. When you start changing two different things, there's what our actuary says, there's some friction between it. because the original COLA projection is now going to be modified for the people who are out of state because their benefit's going to be lower. So, when we give you the estimate on this, and I can tell you, we don't have the formal, but I just got an email here from our actuary, and it saves somewhere around this bill, both elements, save somewhere around $460 million over the biennia, and that's about a 2.5% decrease in rates. So if you looked at that earlier chart where we were going to get to a cruising altitude of 25% rates, we now would be 2.5% below that. We get to a cruising altitude of about 22.5. So it's about a 10% reduction in overall employer rates. Not 10 percentage points of payroll, but about a 10% reduction. And it does bend the cost curve. Anytime you can reduce costs by 10%, that's not inconsequential. And we'll have that analysis for you, and we'll get that to you from there. Steve is prepared to speak to some of the implementation questions. I know there's a part of the bill is to for the board to recalculate the rates and pass that 2.5% savings through in this biennia. We're prepared to do that. That's what happened in 2003, and there's some other implementation features as well. So I'll stop there, co-chairs, and we'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay, well, thank you for all that information. And are there any questions for folks from the agency? Yes, Representative.
I have the same one.
Representative Berger.
In this projection of $460 million per biennium, how much is sort of projected? And I know these are approximate for the first year, and how much for the second year?
Co-Chair Rosenbaum and or Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Berger, I don't know that we'll be able to break the dollar amounts up. I can tell you how we give you the rate savings, and we project that the payroll grows by 3.75% every year. So the savings in the second year of the biennium will be 3.75% more than the savings in the first year of the biennium, is how we do that. But rent mainly, we focus on what's the impact on the rates, 2.5%. That's what helps employers. They know what their individual payroll is and what it's growing. They need to know the rate information.
Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, in his testimony, Senator Devlin talked about indexing and cost of living inflation. And as I understand it, the biennial savings that's being calculated is actually an actuarial projection of how much would be saved over the the next whatever 30 years or X number of years, and then annualized. We can expect over the next 20, 30 years, there's going to be a certain amount of bracket creep, right? I mean, as presumably people's benefits will be increasing because their salaries will be increasing over time. And I'm wondering if that was taken into your calculation, and also if there is merit in indexing those brackets over time, or would that have a substantial impact on the annualized savings that we're looking at? Does that make sense?
Yes, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Denbrough. Let me start with your last question. The what impact would indexing have on this? And we looked at this without indexing. I can tell you that when we looked at the $24,000 cap 2 years ago, we looked at it with a rough indexing, and I believe the savings was about $570 million. With it out being indexed, the savings was about $810. So it's the indexing would strip away, I don't know, in that case, what, a third? I'm doing this math in my head here, but about a third of it. One of the things that you might consider is the fact that the legislature always has the ability to grant ad hoc increases. And if you get back into a situation where the system's in great shape and we've got money sitting in reserve somewhere, that might be an approach you want to take. The if you index it, you put it back on autopilot again, and you lose some of that savings. In terms of how does this grow over the biennium, how do we project this? Our projections are out over about a 70-year period, but the benefit stream is discounted 8%. So when you get out in those late years, you know, the payments are very minimal on a discounted present net value basis. So we focus on our 20-year amortization period, and so the savings of this bill would be 2.5% of payroll every year over that 20%, over that 20-year amortization period, and the payroll we project to grow at 3.75%. So the dollar savings will increase at 3.75% a year over that 20-year period. Every biennium there'll be a higher savings, but the rate saving will be the same. After 20 years, the unfunded liability portion of that rate savings will disappear, and it'll just be a normal cost savings, so it'll be lower going forward after that 20-year period, but our focus is on that 20-year period.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, thank you for your testimony. If I heard you correctly, you said that by the close of business tomorrow, Thursday, you'll have us some detailed information about how Senate Bill 822 is going to impact perhaps some of these similar charts that you provided with how the world looks today. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, by close of business tomorrow, we will have the formal peer-reviewed caveated letter from our actuary. I can tell you today what the results are, and it's a decrease of about 2.5% of pay, which for next biennium converts to about $460 million in savings.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So the question I have, this chart is very helpful.
Right.
So how does Senate Bill 822 impact the lines on this chart?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, excellent question. It would drop those lines by 2.5% across the board.
All the way out.
All the way out, because this is over our projection period. So that's what I was saying. Instead of rates going to 25% and staying there, they'd go to 22.5%. So that's kind of your 10% savings over that time period. So again, if you added it up over you know, 10 biennia, that's where you get into this, you know, multiple billion-dollar savings.
Again, just to clarify, Madam Chair, if I could, but it doesn't necessarily. It just drops the line 2%, but it doesn't affect the trajectory of the line.
Chair Rosenbaum, yes. Senator Starr, there's another part to this bill that will project or will affect the early part of that, and that is, I believe, in talking with the bill proponents, the two co-chairs, they want to incorporate a budget note to us, you know, as part of our fiscal on this bill, directing the board to reshape the rate increase that we've got scheduled for this year. It currently is 5. I'm going to round this number. I think it's 4.9, but 5. To cap that at 3 and to push about 2 of that into the next biennium. So right now, our rates need to go up 7%. Under our current schedule, 5% this biennium, 2% next biennium, this biennium being 13-15. The request is to reshape that, instead of taking 5 this biennium, take 3 this biennium, and then next biennium, take the other 3 then. So, you know, you convert it like that. But you still get to the same cruising altitude. It's just a different climb rate. You still get there. But if you pass the liability reductions, you drop that cruising altitude by 2.5% of pay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Representative Holtby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, I'm curious. I think I've heard this explanation before, but it's still real cloudy to me. When you're talking about these contribution rate projections, you know, you're basing this on the assumption that you have a 20-year amortization, and I'm wondering, because I know a lot of other pensions around the country use 25 years. What does 25 years do to this chart? And why wouldn't we consider that?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Holby, it would move the lines some, It actually, 25-year, you have some negative amortization in the early years, so your unfunded liability actually increases. So again, it would affect your climb rate, but it would lower it in the early years, but you'd actually end up going to a higher rate because of that. One of the reasons why we use the 20-year amortization period, several reasons. One of them is to avoid that negative amortization period. The other is it matches up really well with our demographics. Our average duration for our retirees, expected lifespan of the existing retired members, as well as the remaining working span of our non-retired members, matches really well with the 20-year period. It's actually a little bit less, about 17. Those are the two reasons. We want to avoid negative amortization, and we want to have good intergenerational equity. Our rate smoothing, in essence, creates for those early years, because we smooth our rates out over three biennia. You know, that rate increase that in 2011 would have been 11% if we'd have taken it immediately. Instead, we did kind of a 4 or 5 2 over 6 years. That, in essence, makes it look an awful lot like a 25-year amortization in the early years, but you avoid the negative amortization period.
Okay, I don't see any other questions from committee members, so we... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kenemer.
Yeah, I guess I have a little different question, and I'm not sure I know enough to understand some of this stuff, but part of my concern is in the PERS benefits, you were talking about something in the neighborhood of $30,000 a year annually. On the other hand, there are a bunch of folks involved in the money match and often working 5 to 10 years, and somehow that seems to skew that dramatically, and I wondered if you could help me with that.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Kenemer, you're right in terms of money match will likely be the benefit for anyone who's had an extended inactive period, because that means their account continues to grow. And if they're a Tier 1 member, and we're talking Tier 1, Tier 2 isn't going to go money match almost regardless of this. If you're talking Tier 1 and you went inactive back before the go-go years of the 80s and 90s, you definitely are going to be going out at a pretty healthy benefit. And compared to your final salary, it's going to be a pretty astronomical replacement rate. And we also have a lot of those inactive members that tend to just hold on to that account. They, you know, there's nothing that forces them to retire until they get to 70 and a half, when they have to do the required minimum distribution. So if you don't need the money, where can you get an 8% guaranteed account? There, one of the concepts that we analyzed, because people asked us to look at it, was what would happen if you eliminated money match for inactive people. And it's interesting, it's a substantial savings. As a matter of fact, it's about the equal to what we're talking about here today. It's about $442 million or so.
Follow up? Go ahead.
This proposal doesn't address that issue.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Kenemer, you're right. It doesn't.
Okay, and Mr. Roderman, did you have additional testimony?
No,
you're just here for questions. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. And
we'll see.
Okay, I'll be here if we have additional questions. Thanks. And I'm assuming you'll be back tomorrow morning when
we will,
take
Madam
this
Chair.
Up.
Thank you.
Okay. And so next we have Senator Knopf, who's been waiting very patiently, and I understand you might have a couple of colleagues that wanted to sit with you. Nope. Okay, I guess you'll go it alone then. Thanks very much for waiting so patiently.
Thank you. My name is Senator Tim Knopf, representing Senate District 27, including Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And I'll try to be as brief as I can, because I know the folks behind me will want to testify before they come pick up my office later. So, as you know, I've been involved with the PERS issue since 2002, when we had the interim committee. And first, I want to thank the legislative leadership and the chairs of this committee for having a hearing on PERS, because I know how difficult it is, and I know It's not an issue an easy issue to deal with. It's very complicated. I do want to say that Senate Bill 822 doesn't do everything that we believe that it needs to do, as the House or the Senate Republican Caucus almost diverted back to 2003. And really, 822 really fails to fully fund education, and in some cases, it kicks the can down the road as it relates to the collaring aspects of the plan. The governor's purse plan, at his suggested funding level, also doesn't fund our schools at a level that won't result in cuts, because it is a cuts budget, at least for my district, and I imagine it is for many years as well. And it's clear that some of these proposals aren't seen as real PERS reform, and I believe this session we really do need real PERS reform. I think we need to finish what was started in 2003. The OSBA PERS bill is a good starting point, and I think what we tried to do is enhance that bill. And so I'm inviting you to join us on behalf of the Senate Republican Caucus in supporting a bipartisan plan that includes elements from your Democrat plan, the governor's plan, the OSBA plan, and elements from Representative Barker, Conger, Hanna, Senator Burdick, and Whitsitt's plans, as well as myself. Now, not all of you have signed on to the plan at this point, but we did design it to be inclusive and bipartisan. It's a real and serious PERS reform, and it saves enough to get us as close as we can to fully funding education. Now, while some blame Wall Street for PERS problems, I distributed to you a page from a report from PERS called PERS by the Numbers. If you look at this chart, you can see between 1979, if you look between the yellow lines, between 1979 and 1999, PERS employee accounts were significantly overcredited. So we can't just blame Wall Street for this problem. We know that the PERS board and inaction by the legislature during that time period helped cause some of this PERS crisis. And while I wouldn't blame retirees or PERS members during this time period, they were beneficiaries of that mismanagement of PERS crediting. And really it is my goal to offer you two amendments, and that is a dash one and a dash two. The dash one is the OSBA plan, Senate Bill 754. And the dash two is a plan that includes nine elements. We tried to pull together the elements, the best elements from each of the plans. So the nine elements include the elimination of the tax remedy payment for non-Oregonians, limiting the cost of living adjustments, similar to what's done in 822, although we start at 1.5% for the first 24,000 for retirees' pension, and go to 0.5% or 0.5% for between 24 and 36,000, and 0.1% for everything above 36,000, and it doesn't adjust for inflation. It's very progressive. It also redirects a 6% from Tier 1 and Tier 2 member contributions from the individual account program into separate accounts. It reduces money match annuity rate from 8 to 4%, which is the approximate market rate for employees who become eligible to retire after January 1, 2014. It removes overtime and unused vacation and paid leave for the calculation of final average salary for Tier 1 and Tier 2 for employees who become eligible to retire on or after January 1st, 2014. It also removes the overtime calculation and final average salary for OPSR beginning January 1st, 2014. It allows employers to negotiate a 6% pickup lower than 6%. It also adds a new 2% employee contribution requirement on top of the existing 6% requirement that most employers already pick up. And finally, it removes legislators from PERS. It is a significant reform. It likely pegs the number somewhere at $1.9 billion. We have about a $2 billion problem as it pertains to rates. And I think we need to solve that problem. And we can't just put it off on our cities and counties, local governments, and our school districts. If we don't act, we all know that it's going to be a substantial impact on K through 12 and through all service budgets, and we're going to have to deal with that in some way. Currently, our caucus does not have any votes for SB 822. We did commit 14 votes to the Senate President on Senate Bill 754, but we believe that we can improve upon that bill, and we'd ask you to join us. We're not tied to the elements necessarily in this bill, but we do believe that we should hit that $1.9 billion number and solve this problem. And that will, as Senator Starr was looking for, it will bend that cost curve back to the point where we believe it'll be sustainable. I recognize that FAIR is going to be in the eye of the account holder, but I would suggest to you that there is a necessary time to do PERS reform. That time is now. We've waited a decade, and I'm happy to help in any way I can to assure that we get real PERS reform out of this 2013 session. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Senator Canope. And I appreciate that you've done a lot of work in this area. I did want to just mention for people that might follow that we're trying to, in this hearing, focus on Senate Bill 822, and we're also trying to get as many members of the public, some of whom have traveled from some distance, to be heard today, because on the Senate side, we do have another hearing scheduled at 8:30 tomorrow morning, which will be a public hearing and potentially a work session on the bill, so there will be plenty of time to offer amendments and go through that part of the process. Any questions for Senator Canope? Yes, Representative Hoyle.
First of all, I want to thank you so much for your invitation to join you in supporting your bill and the Senate Republicans' proposal. And I just like to say that from a House Democrat's perspective, that we are not willing to sign on to that plan or the OSBA plan, because Democrats believe that there should be shared sacrifice and that it should be fair, and this plan does not represent our values. So thank you so much for the invitation, but we will not be able to join you in that. I also take a little bit of issue with your definition of bipartisan. Because you have aspects of different people's proposals, I'll take Representative Barker's proposal on out-of-state retirees. That doesn't mean he actually supports your plan.
Correct.
So having aspects of Democrats' proposals in the plan doesn't make it bipartisan. So, again, I appreciate where you're going and that you're working to come to some kind of agreement, but I want to be clear, the plan that's been put forward is really, really difficult for many of us to look at, but we understand that there should be shared sacrifice. And I would invite you and the Senate Republicans to join us in a revenue plan that would be dollar to dollar equal to the savings that we're asking retirees, teachers, and firefighters and police officers to pay. So we'd invite you to join us in that. And then I think, finally, you know, I have over 2,000 emails from people asking me to defend that I took, reminding me that I took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and that of the state of Oregon, and to defend their Second and Fourth Amendment rights, which I have always done. But I think a little less sexy is Article 1 and Section 10 of the Constitution that says no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. And the fact is that our co-chairs have put out something that, again, is going to be a difficult vote. I've committed to take it. But at the end of the day, they believe that it is legal. They believe that it is the most fair option that we have in a bad situation. And I can tell you from my perspective that House Democrats won't be able to join you in that, but we would welcome you joining us in a different package, and we'd love to talk to you about that.
Thank you, Representative Hoyle. Any other comments, questions? Okay, I don't see any, so thank you very much, Senator Canope. And moving right along, I see other legislators, but my understanding is nobody is here to testify, just to listen. Okay, so at this point then, I think we'll start taking people from the list, and just in case you weren't here at the beginning. We are going to hear from as many people as possible. As I said, a lot of people have traveled from some distance. We have a timer up here. We're going to cut you off when your 3 minutes are up. And so we'll start right in. I'm calling panels of three, and in the order that they're signed up, Jim Green, Bill Geary, and Dave Johnson will be our first panel of three. And after them on deck will be Rick Bennett, Greg Hartman, and Tom Beeman. So you can be ready, so we won't waste any time.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, welcome to the difficult task of PERS. This is not only a difficult task because you deal with people's lives, because it's a tricky vote politically, and it's a very complex legalistic system. One of the things I would say about Senate Bill 822 is our association.
I'm sorry, did you identify yourself?
Jim Green, yes,
okay,
I did.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that our association believes that 822 is a good start, and we do thank the co-chairs for bringing the ideas forward. As you've heard, we have a bill that has other ideas in it, but I will stick to the 822 bill today. And I brought Bill Geary with me, one of the attorneys that has argued these issues for a very long time, and he can walk you through some of the legal questions that you may have. I want to point out one thing for you. When Paul Cleary talks about a rate, that's a system-wide rate, and who I represent are school districts. As a matter of fact, I'm a local school board member, so I deal with this issue on a day-to-day basis. And if you do nothing this session, the rate for school districts will go to near 27%. In my school district, the Salem-Keizer School District, that is a $17 million cost increase. And we've already cut $125 million out of our budget, laid off 425 FTE. As an example, to run our school district day-to-day is $1 million. We could sure close school for 17 days, but a furlough day is a really nice word for teachers not getting paid, educational professionals not getting paid, and students not getting educated. Furlough days are something we do because we have to, but we're not going to do it in this manner. If you only enact Senate Bill 822, our rates still stay high. I think the chart that you've seen from Mr. Cleary from PERS, our rates for school districts still stay high. And you're going to hear a lot about promises today and a lot about contracts. And I'd like to go back to the promise that Representative Buckley started with, which is our promise to our school children, to provide them a world-class education and have them ready in a globally competitive marketplace. We can't do that at the level of PERS increases we're seeing in school districts. We plain and simple cannot do that. We understand this impacts people's lives and folks who have retired, and we think that there's a plan that's balanced, fair, and legal that can go forward with that. But we don't believe Senate Bill 822 is the answer. We've put proposals out there that give you different opportunities to take a look at that. One of the problems I see in this proposal, and it's not in the bill, but Mr. Cleary talked about it, was the rate collar. A rate collar is nothing more than kicking the can down the road. You're not going to make payments on a debt you owe. You don't run your households that way. You don't run your businesses that way. And it's sure not a way to run the state when it relates to this issue. I know I'm getting close on time. There's lots of folks that want to testify, so I'm happy to answer any questions.
Oh, great. So you can see the light. That
yes, we can.
Can't you? Okay. Yeah, why don't we hear from everybody, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Geary, please go ahead and say your name for the record.
Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committee, I'm Bill Geary. I'm a shareholder in the law firm of Harang Long, Geary Rudnick. My firm had the privilege to be lead counsel both in the legislative battles over the PERS reforms in 2003 and in the litigation that followed on behalf of local governments and school districts. You have heard, unless you've been out of the country for quite a while, from my friends in the public employee unions that there is nothing that you can do to PERS without it breaching a contract to the members. And there is no question that the Supreme Court has long ago held that PERS is a contract. And it has held that that contract is contained in the statutes that this body enacts. But in the Strunk case, it went further than that and opposed the question, what is
the contract, what are the terms of that contract, and it held very clearly that not every statute that this body enacts concerning PERS is a part of the contract. The contract is what the Supreme Court refers to as a statutory contractual promise, and that is a promise by one legislative body to bind all future legislative bodies to say we will not change this promise. That, as you can imagine, is contrary to basic civics, which says one legislative body cannot bind future legislative bodies. And the court has made that exception, but it has made it clear that it will only find a statutory contractual promise if there is a clear manifestation of intent by the legislature to make that binding promise. And so in Strunk, looking at the 2003 reforms, it looked at each individual provision to ask itself, does this reflect the legislature's intent to make a contractual promise that will bind future legislatures? And with respect to some of the 2003 reforms, it said yes, and it invalidated the reforms that changed those promises. With respect to other provisions in the 2003 reforms, the bulk of the reforms, which you heard today from several people, reforms that are working, it said they were not part of the contract. And so when somebody tells you you can't change PERS because it's a contract, you need to ask, well, what are the terms of the contract? With respect to the cost of living adjustment, the Supreme Court addressed subsection 1 of ORS 238.360, which is the COLA provision, and it said that the legislature had intended to promise that members would receive a COLA. It expressly did not deal with the second part of that statute, which talks about a cap on the amount of the COLA. And that's the issue that's before you in the bill that you're considering today. I've prepared a letter of advice, which I presented to Jim Green, that's been shared with all of you, dated March 11th, that analyzes Senate Bill 754 and specifically each of the provisions and addresses the COLA. And
Mr. Gary, I hate to interrupt you. You are actually out of time, and I wanted to point out for members of the audience and people listening that those documents that you're referring to now are posted on our OLIS website, so everybody can look at them as you're speaking. If you could just take 30 seconds to wrap up, that would be great.
Yes, thank you. The last thing I want to say, and I too have more to say on the other proposals that are out there, but with respect to the COLA, I know that this is hard. I know that no one wants to be confronted with this decision. I would urge you to look at the problems that exist within PERS. It isn't that the benefits are too high. It is that they are arbitrary and random, and that's caused by the money match. You heard earlier that that inactive employees receive higher benefits in many cases. People with a few years of service at the beginning of their career who leave their money in PERS receive higher monthly benefits than people who spent their entire life working for the public. That makes no sense, and that's something that this body should address. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, go ahead, Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a question for Mr. Green. Can you just clarify for me your position on the rate collaring aspect of this? It has been criticized by some as kicking the can down the road, but as I understand it, rate collaring is something the PERS Board has done throughout time to help smooth over increases. So is it really that you're opposing that or that you just don't see it as sufficient?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett, we opposed when PERS implemented the rate collar that they've got in place right now. We believe that that is also moving money down the road that we ought to be paying today. Does that raise our rates? Yes, it raises our rates, but it does get money into the system. I think if you put an additional rate collar or skip payment in the system, it causes the system to end up costing more in the long run.
Okay.
And I would say, to Representative Hoyle's point, Representative Hoyle, we want to join in that conversation that Representative Barnhart and Senator Burdick are doing with regard to revenue. We believe you have to look at cost containment that's in the PERS system, which was before you today, as well as that element of revenue. So we will join you in that discussion.
Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gary, I just wanted to follow up your comment about money match and it being a big factor, and I presume then you think that that is a factor that could be adjusted under your theory that the contracts are subject to being reviewed.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Kinnamer, I think that Strunk fairly is read to mean that the money match is a part of the PERS contract. The benefit calculation statute itself is. But the way the money match works, it is taking the account of a member and creating an annuity, a stream of income from that, and then doubling it. And what the statute says is that the stream of income should be the actuarial equivalent to the pool of money that is being converted. And there are two factors that are used to determine actuarial equivalence. One is life expectancy, how long is this person going to be receiving the benefit? And the other is what interest can we assume the money is going to make while before it is paid out? The actuarial factors that are used now use current mortality. In 2003, some of you may remember, they were using outdated mortality tables, and the legislature told PERB to use current mortality. But they are using a conversion factor for interest of 8%. An 8% conversion rate does not produce actuarial equivalence. It means that the stream of income is more valuable than the pool of money that is being converted, because you can't get an 8% annuity anywhere in the market. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, a federal corporation, produces quarterly reports on conversion rates. And I think not only that this body could direct PERB to use those conversion rates, but that if PERB continues to use an 8% conversion rate, it is violating the law because it is not producing actuarial equivalence.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any. I'm sorry, Representative Hicks.
Just one question. Go ahead. Mr. Gary, my understanding, what I'm gathering is that contract law comes down to what was originally in the contract. And so what I'm gathering from it, largely it can't. Contracts are binding, and so what I'm gathering from your brief, from your description here, is that the aspects of Senate Bill 754 that you've analyzed were not in the original contract. Is that fair to say?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hicks, I think in general that is right. With regard to the way that Senate Bill 754 is structured, there are things that I would do differently. This is very technical, obviously. But in general, I think the concepts that were described by Representative Canope, or Senator Canope, excuse me, I'm back in 2003 also, are generally things that we believe the legislature can effect change without breaching the agreement that it has with its PERS members and its employees.
Okay, thank you both. And I think we have Dave Johnson, is that right? Okay.
Correct.
So we'll keep going, and your 3 minutes start now.
Thank you. My name is Dave Johnson. I live in Southwest Portland. I've lived there for more than 30 years. I'm the former board chair of the I Have a Dream Foundation of Oregon, and I'm a member of Stand for Children. I'm testifying today in opposition to Senate Bill 822. I'm also testifying as a representative of Stan's School Finance Task Force. I want to start by praising you for putting PERS reform on the agenda for this legislative session. Pension reform is a thorny issue that requires lots of effort, discussion, and thought to do what's right for Oregon citizens, including retired public employees. So kudos to all of you for taking on this difficult topic. Stan's School Finance Task Force was formed last year to get a deeper understanding of the issues related to both revenue and spending for Oregon's public schools. Our 10 members include parents, teachers, school board members, and community leaders from across the state. We have spent more than 25 hours in meetings learning about and discussing school finance issues. On the topics of PERS reform, we heard from a range of well-informed speakers. It's the conclusion of our task force that despite the reforms in 96 and 2003, that significant further PERS reform is needed. We believe that while some benefits are reasonable for employees and sustainable by employers, that not others are not. It's our conclusion that Peer's financial problems have not been caused by the stock market crash. We concluded that the problems are driven by excessive benefit guarantees and lack of fiscal prudence by the legislature and PERS board during the boom years of the 80s and 90s. We urge the legislature to return PERS back to its original intent of providing a reasonable retirement income of 85% of final year's pay when combined with Social Security benefits. Our task force is recommending four specific steps in this legislative session to reform PERS. Control the annual cost of living increases for PERS recipients. Eliminate the Oregon tax reimbursement for out-of-state recipients. Use market rate of return for money match annuity option instead of the fixed 8%. And redirect the employee's 6% contributions to PERS general fund instead of individual accounts. Our task force also believes that it's critical to think long-term when proposing reforms for PERS. Yes, the next biennium is important, but the impact for the next 20 years. Senate Bill 822 is unacceptable to our task force, most importantly because it dismally fails the 20-year test. The bill derives half of its savings simply by deferring $350 million in payments to future years. If adopted, this would cause the continued lack of fiscal prudence and discipline that were original causes of the PERS problem.
Mr. Johnson, we have your time is up, and we do have your written statement. If you could just conclude.
So we strongly urge the legislature to be fiscally responsible and adopt comprehensive PERS reform, and that will significantly reduce PERS costs over the next 20 years. And we ask that you please give serious consideration to our four key points. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And I don't see any questions, so we will thank you for your testimony. We'll call the next panel. And as I said before, that will be Rick Bennett, Greg Hartman, and Tom Beeman.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I heard you correctly, I would defer my testimony until tomorrow morning and allow others who perhaps can't come back.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll call Greg Hartman, Tom Beeman, and Paul Zastro. And please just go right ahead. We don't want to waste time on formalities.
Thank you, Chairman.
Other than your name.
Chair Garrett, members of the Joint Committee, my name is Tom Beeman, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 822. I've been a teacher in Oregon for 31 years. When I was 22 years old, I went to a PERS workshop because there's nothing else to do in Roseburg in the evenings. And so I found out that what PERS was and proceeded to work my career. I raised a family, and I planned for retirement based on contracts that had been negotiated over the years that included a reasonable pension. Over the years, I've watched the private sector abandon their retirees by dismantling their pension systems. I've also seen the state legislature try to address what the Oregonian calls a broken pension system for the public. And each time, these changes that have been implemented have resulted in unintended consequences. I am one of those real people that a Ways and Means Senate Chair Devlin referred to. Senate Bill 822 will cost me upwards of $150,000 over the course of my retirement. I am already at the top of the salary schedule for my school. I have been there for 17 years. I could retire right now, but I can't because you are taking from me $150,000 over the course of my retirement. This means that I will continue to work, and this will cost my school district over $30,000 next year, which could be saved if I were to retire. If this is done across the entire state government system, according to earlier testimony today, where there are 70,000 current PERS employees who are eligible for retirement, that totals over $1 billion in current expenditures that could be saved if that math holds true across the board. I thought the idea of Senate Bill 22 and other reforms was to give the school districts more money next year and not less. There are other unintended consequences that are likely. For instance, further reductions in the existing COLA cap. It's important to understand that the COLA is not a guaranteed 2%, but a cap on our cost of living opportunities for retirees will hurt retirees. This may make our retirees eligible for public assistance, pushing them below the poverty level. Despite what was recently quoted in the Oregonian, $20,000 is not an upper, middle, or higher income. It is instead near poverty level. The bottom line is that it's not fair to those people who are close to retirement, and even less fair to those in retirement, to change their retirement because they've already spent their entire lives making plans based on the system as it currently exists. On behalf of me, on behalf of my wife, who stands to lose over $100,000 when she retires, on behalf of my 87-year-old in-laws, I urge you not to hold us responsible for the greed and poor decisions made by multimillionaires on Wall Street. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for teaching the kids of Oregon. Please go ahead.
Okay, Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. I'm Paul Zastro. I live in Hood River. I am a long-time teacher. I also am a public school employee, which is kind of obvious, but I retired 15 years ago. And I retired not under Money Match, but under Annuity Plus, because they found it at that time, it was to my benefit at $8.89 per month better. Finally, after 15 years of retirement, my income from retirement is actually equal to what I had when I was teaching. That's not a very good statement, I don't believe, of saying that it's a rich system. I see no reason that we have to go to another tiered system, or even the tier 2 and tier 3, without allowing what happened in both 96 and 2003 to come to fruition. And I think probably one of the things that I resent the most is that it appears to me that almost all of the systems we have out there, proposals we have out there right now, isn't one of looking at the true unfunded liability. It's looking at where are we going to get income to fund schools. That's the thing I hear. We need to have $200, $400, $800 million during the biennium picked up. But where is it going to be picked up? Off the backs of our retirees. We're not saying at all under these plans, let's look at shared sacrifice. Instead, it's off those of us who are current retirees or those who will be shortly. The PERS system did not get bankrupted necessarily by those of us who retired. It's not our fault. And it's really, to some extent, not the fault of you who are gathered here now, except possibly Senator Courtney. I think he might have been there through most of this. Only because of his tenure here in Salem, not because of anything he's done personally. But I think the problem lies primarily with the last big hit, with those, I would have to say, the banksters and the money managers who, through their own faults, created the gigantic, catastrophic hit that almost all retirement programs had, and of course Oregon also suffered. A couple other things I think we need to look at too is that any plan should have three significant things. One, it should honestly, truly save money. This one doesn't really save money as such because it takes money from one pocket or one back and puts it somewhere else. It should be constitutional. Well, there's definitely debate, and I guess the only way we're going to find out whether it's constitutional or not is to allow it to be signed into law and then be adjudicated in the courts. That's going to cost money and time. And lastly, it should be fair. Workers and seniors can't become the real losers making those plan cuts to allocations as well as decreasing the potential retirement. I think we have to look also specifically at contract law. At one time stated that we would get that 2%, that we would have a decent retirement income. This changes that game.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chairman, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm an attorney, the attorney for the Perse Coalition. I've been proud to do that for the last 25 or so years and have had the opportunity to argue many of the cases you ultimately discuss, including arguing with my colleague and friend Bill Gary, who testified earlier today. It probably doesn't come as a huge surprise to you to tell you that I do not agree with Bill Gary and everything he says, not only about Senate Bill 822, but about some of the other things he managed to testify to today. I would be happy to engage him in a debate on those issues, which I don't think you'd find all that enlightening. I would suggest that rather than spending a lot of time worrying about what I think or what Mr. Gary thinks, you might most profitably go back to your own counsel, legislative counsel, who has delivered an opinion to you. Now, this was in the context of the governor's original proposal, saying that that proposal was not likely to be upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court. And I will suggest to you that this issue of whether the court talked about Section 1 or Section 2, Section 3, misses the entire point. Because the fundamental question, and I think Mr. Gary and I do agree on this, the fundamental question that the court will address is when the legislature passed the current statute back in 1973, 40 years ago, did they intend to make a commitment that this, in fact, was a contract? And if you look at the language, if you look at the history, you go back and we have looked at this history, and the constant comments about a permanent solution to the COLA problem, I think you'll come up with a single conclusion, and that is the legislature did intend to make a contract. Now, with all respect to the co-chairs, and by the way, I want to say I understand the difficult position they're in, and I appreciate their efforts to look for equity and fairness. But from my narrow point of view, and I get to have a narrow point of view, I think that there is no principal difference between the governor's proposal and the proposal that you have before you in Senate Bill 822. And by that I mean, if the legislature in 1973 made a contract and said we are going to pay a COLA cap to 2% and so forth and so on, then any proposal which does not honor that contract is going to be found to be in violation of the contract and will not be sustained by the Oregon Supreme Court. They're not going to look to see whether this is fair in some sense or equitable or whatever. The fundamental question they're going to have is, was there a contract and does this breach the contract? Two quick other points. I do want to point out to you, and I think it's already been raised before, this will have a significant impact on your active folks. This doesn't just impact retirees, and I think you need to understand that as you go forward and think about this bill. And then one quick word on the out-of-state component of your bill. I think there was a mention earlier that the out-of-state tax remedy came in two parts. I think you'd have to look at those two parts differently. I did hand up two memos earlier that kind of bullet point memos addressing those topics. So I'd like to say more, but I see the red light is on, so happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Testimony. Any questions? So I did want to ask you, because I have one memo from you, but I haven't seen two, and I'm not sure whether you submitted them directly for this hearing.
Yes, I did, and they look very similar. If you look at them, they're both on letterhead, but one says legal analysis regarding COLA, and the other one says legal analysis regarding out-of-state retirees. So they look similar, but they're two separate documents.
Okay, great. And we'll make sure those are, I think they probably are already posted on our website. And it looks like Senator Meyer has a question. Go ahead.
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Hartman, I'm sitting here looking at 238.360.
Yes.
And thinking back to the Strunk decision, it's pretty clear. Well, in fact, it's not ambiguous at all that the court said that the first paragraph in there is a constitutional contract. That's what they said. The arguments that I have read from the various attorneys is that there is some kind of distinction between sub 1 and sub 2, 3, and 4. Can you help me get there? I haven't been able to get to figure out what the legal distinction is between those four sections.
Senator, in all honesty, neither have I. because I can't find any principal distinction between those four sections. And if you go back historically and you look at the bill as it existed back in 1973, it was organized somewhat differently and was not divided into those sections. So it's hard for me to understand how the legislature back in 1973 may have intended some part of this to be contractual, and yet other parts of what appears to be a consistent cost of living 2% bank, which just seems to be a package, if you will. It's hard for me to understand that as well. So I wish I could help you, but I can't, because I can't figure it out either. Seems to me it's all one thing.
If I may, thank you. I don't have the benefit of having spent the amount of time you have on this. Was the change separating it from 73 to the current structure, was that just the codification, or was there actually statutory changes enacted by the legislature?
It was not a codification. There was a statutory change, but if you look at it, it was not a substantive change. It was one of these changes that happened from time to time where, if you compare, there was absolutely no change in substance. But they reordered the sections somewhat from the way the bill was originally passed back in 1973.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. And just, I don't want to drag this out anymore, but it seems like the fundamental question that's being debated, and I think at this point there are so many legal opinions floating around, some free from our own counsel and some being paid for by various entities, but it seems like the fundamental question is that everybody agrees that some portion of the COLA or the existence of a COLA is part of the contract, but then other lawyers than you have gone on to say that the rate of the COLA can be changed by the legislature without impairing the contract. And I apparently you believe both the rate and the existence of a COLA at all are both part of the contract and the rate cannot be changed?
I would agree. In other words, if you go back to 1973 and you say, what did the legislature do back in 73? They passed a package. You really can't, how do you separate one from the other? They passed a package that said, from this point forward, there'll be a cost of living increase. They were specific about how we're going to measure that cost of living. It will be capped in any one year at 2%, and we will maintain what sometimes it's been called a bank, so that if we don't have 2% in one year, but we've not taken a full amount of the COLA, you can use that. That's really a single package. I don't know how you sort that out and say, well, the legislature meant this part to be contractual, but not that part. I can't find any principal difference between those. So I think it's all one package.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and
thank you.
I will call three more people, and they are Margie Brown, Claire Morgan, and Rich Jones. And after them, we'll move right into page two, which is James Jacobson, Frank Gillard, and Mark Feldisman. So if the three of you could be ready to just jump up, we'll try to get through as many people as possible. Is Margie Brown still here? I know we have an overflow room. Great.
And members on the House Committee website, the legal analysis is posted. It's posted and identified as legal analysis under Mr. Jack's testimony, and both documents are together. And just for the public, if you're looking on the House Rules OLA site, that is where the legal analysis just talked about is posted.
Okay, please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, co-chairs, Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Garrett, and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Margie Brown, and I'm a member of Stand for Children and a grandparent of two children in the Portland Public Schools. And I'm here today to oppose components of SB 822. I wanted to start by saying that I believe PERS reform should be fair to retirees, but also make the system sustainable and dependable for future employees. Once we have fair, impactful PERS reform, we can begin to hire teachers back, reduce class sizes, and bring back classes like music and PE. We need reforms to help our schools get back on their feet. SB 822 is a great first step in that direction, but it is only a first step. We believe the legislature must go further to address the total firm's liability. While there are other proposals that reduce the liability by nearly $10 billion, SB 822 only reduces the liability by $3 billion. We want our schools to be able to begin to hire back teachers, have smaller class sizes, and more classes available to open our children's minds to new experiences and better prepare them for the future needs of our economy. We cannot do this without really addressing the PERS liability. If this legislature can pass meaningful PERS reform, we can start down the path to restoring and rejuvenating our schools. If we do not act now in a meaningful way, we are ensuring today's toddlers go to schools that will continue to struggle to provide mediocre education. We have divested in public education in Oregon for too long, so we have a lot of catching up to do. Partial adjustments will not be enough. Thank you for your time and attention to this important issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, members of the State House and Senate Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Claire Morgan, and I am a Stanford Children member in Hillsborough. I am here today to share my concerns about Senate Bill 822, introduced by the co-chairs of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. My perspective is somewhat unique. I am a recipient of Tier 1 PERS benefits that are 80% of what I earned when I retired after teaching 37 years. My sister and daughter-in-law are currently teaching and are stressed trying to do the best for their students under very difficult situations while still having their salaries frozen and reduced by furloughs. Hillsborough, the school district from which I retired, will suffer a $12 million budget shortfall for 2013 to 2014 and $9 million shortfall for 2014 to 15 under the $6.55 billion proposed by Senate Bill 822. My grandson will be in Hillsborough school in 2 years. Hillsborough school in 2 years under these impossible conditions. I am in leadership and a member of Stanford Children, and I'm a member of Oregon Education Association Retired. My viewpoint falls somewhere in the middle of these two organizations. I believe that PERS needs some reforms, but not in this haphazard emergency fashion. I want a PERS that is fair for all involved, and I am willing to sacrifice some of my COLA now for the education of the children of Oregon. Who else in this state is willing to sacrifice for the education of Oregon's children other than state employees? I think we need to ensure everyone is a part of the solution. There are bills that are on the docket right now, Senate Bill 593, 594, 595, and 671, that will give more tax breaks for corporations and the wealthy. Since the bills haven't moved yet, hopefully the sponsors are thinking about it. Senate Bill 822 alone will not solve the education funding necessary for 2013 to 2015. The proposed reforms in Senate Bill 822 will not even come close to stopping the cuts that the schools in Hillsborough are facing the next school year. I want to say again that I believe the legislature should find a solution to this issue, because I believe that with meaningful reforms, we can start down the path to restoring and rejuvenating our schools. For the children of Oregon, everyone needs to help. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I do not see any questions for you. I don't know if Rich Jones is here. He was called on this panel. So we'll move on to the next three people, James Jacobson, Frank Gillard, and Mark Feltesman. If you'd like to come forward, be seated, and start right in. So,
Members of the committees, thank you for having this public hearing. My name is James Jacobson, and I'm a U of O employee, and in Eugene, and I've been there 15 and a half years, and my income is really very low, and my net pay is, I'm in other words, I make under $35,000, about $32,000 a year, and that's I think near poverty level after the taxes and other expenses are taken out. I hope to retire in 3 to 4 years, and I'm not looking forward to it the way the horizon looks now. I am appalled at this proposal, and I'll tell you why. In 2012, we had an election in November. The voters decided to not stop the estate taxes that the wealthy should continue paying. They decided not to to end the corporate kicker. And so the corporation's money, if there is a kicker, goes into public education, K through 12. Many candidates, some of you, ran saying that you wouldn't attack PERS. And we know that PERS is constantly under attack, largely by people who hate unions, who hate public employees, who hate the system as it is now with people getting retirement benefits. They're the same people that have attacked Social Security over 50 years. They've attacked Medicare and all of the other benefits. They want to kill unions. They want to destroy public employees. That's what's going on here. And if you want to know the truth, the voters spoke, and they said, make those who can afford to pay their fair share. You need to find revenue sources elsewhere. You can't play one set of public employees off against the others. The schools against the retirees. The retirees can't afford these cuts. I can't afford the cuts that I'm under right now with the furlough days and the pay cuts and reductions and very tiny COLAs from the university system. I said that it's appalling. At one point, Representative Buckley said something about taking the retirement COLAs is immoral. I think it's reprehensible. I think it's shameful. And I think you've got to stop it and tax the corporations. We are in Oregon tied with North Carolina for the lowest corporate tax rate in the nation. We can afford to ask the wealthy and the corporate interests in this state to pay their share. $17 billion was lost in the market crash, and I think it's directly attributable to the people, the banks, and go after them. The big banks on Wall Street, go after them. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead. And before you do, I'm just going to mention the next three people on deck will be Micheline Mosher, Carla Spence, and Jan Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Goulard. I'm in Representative Garrett's district and Senator Devlin's district, and I'm proud of their representation, and I'm proud of all of you for serving as elected officials for Oregonians. It means a lot to everybody, and so thank you for your tireless, endless service that you perform. As I said, Frank Goulard, Portland Community College Mathematics and Statistics faculty, also with American Federation of Teachers of Oregon. And I appreciated James' comments as well as many comments before me today. As Speaker Kotek said at the outset of the session, three things, and I think a lot of you have repeated it, three things have to happen for a bill to be seriously considered: that it be legal and not unconstitutional, that it save actual money and not shuffle money underneath shells, and thirdly, be fair and not punitive. And I think a lot of folks have spoken to those three topics already. I'll focus on the last one, the fair and not punitive. We can all say that fair is in the eye of the beholder. What to one person is fair, to another person is not fair, and vice versa. But the punitive aspect, and something that resonated when James talked just a moment ago, goes down to Oregonian soul. We Oregonians are a proud and independent bunch, but we also care for our fellow citizenry around the state. And so the punitive part whether it's a graduated COLA, and Representative Dimbro asked about indexing for inflation, which I'm surprised the Senate Bill 822 does not, and I encourage an amendment to that, to index it to inflation. You look at all our IRS tables, the Roth IRAs, the traditional IRAs, 457 plans, 403B plans, 401K plans, they're all indexed for inflation. Our personal exemption for the Oregon Department of Revenue on our income tax returns every year is indexed for inflation. It's gone up 3% a year over the last 15 years. CPI in Oregon over the last 20 as well as 30-year time period has gone up 3% a year. And yet the cap for retirees for their COLA is only 2%. Retirees are already a percent behind each year. And now the suggestion is with this graduated COLA to reduce it slightly further. So you can see the punitiveness that can be discerned by some folks for this Senate Bill 822. But I encourage you to seriously consider indexing for inflation, along with the shared sacrifice that Representative Hoyle mentioned, and some of the others too have mentioned here today. The shared sacrifice, the balance of revenue and cost cutting, is so central to our spirit of compromise, to our spirit of dialogue, whether it's a two-party system or not, that needs to come forth. The last thing I want to say about that was there was an article that came out in the Portland-based newspaper back in January, a Sunday column, a Sunday front page article, that is, that mentioned if you just capped income tax deductions on Oregon tax returns at $50,000 a year, $50,000 a year just for deductions, wow, it's a lot of spending there, then that would save in a biennium $500 million right there. And I don't think anybody would be adversely affected with that kind of proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Feldsman. I'm a retired Portland State University faculty and administrator. And for the last 15 years, I've been following PERS issues fairly closely and have been writing about them from the other side of the curtain in a widely read and widely circulated blog. I'm here to take a slightly different approach than anybody else I think has suggested so far. I'm at heart a cynic. And I'm a cynic because I don't have any real expectation that anything that any of us say today is going to have much impact on what actually takes place. I think that Senate Bill 822, while certainly fairer than all of the other bills I've seen with respect to the COLA, is probably going to pass in one form or another. And so I don't really want to talk about my opinion about Senate Bill 822, but instead I want to mention two things that concern me very deeply, and it gets to the heart of my cynicism about the process. The first thing is that I have heard speaker after speaker after speaker today talk about the unfunded actuarial liability. And while I know that the COLA freeze will, over the years, reduce the unfunded actuarial liability by $3 or maybe $4 billion, my real question is that if people were seriously concerned about the unfunded actuarial liability, they would take the money generated from Senate Bill 822 and dump it directly into the unfunded actuarial liability and return nothing to anybody until the unfunded actuarial liability is eliminated. At that point, we can talk about other forms of funding improvements. The second thing that I want to say, with all due respect to the For the Children people, is they all tell us that this is all about the kids. But the fact of the matter is, having been in higher education, having watched the way administrative sausage is made, I can tell you frankly that education funding is fungible and money just disappears. And unless this group is willing to impose some very strict controls on how the school districts use that money to make sure that it really does return to the classroom, that we're going to be back here at this table again every 2 years from now until the end of time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, and the next witnesses, as I said, are going to be Micheline Mosher, Carla Spence, and Jay Thatcher. And then after them, we're going to take somebody out of order because they have traveled from more than 100 miles. That will be Bob Clem. And with him, we'll be calling Keith Morgan and Glenn Harris. Please go right ahead.
Whichever of you want to go first, go ahead. Senator Rosenbaum, Chair Rosenbaum, and Representative Garrett, and members of the committee. First of all, I want to thank you for being here today in this
and
hot room.
Could you please just say your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to get there. My name is Micheline Mosher. I am wearing the color of the contract that does not allow me to negotiate a better wage with my employer, but I am the Republican usually in the group when we get together. I am a current state employee. You can catalog me as Tier 2. And one of the things that is a difference for me is that I do not have any expectation of having PERS do anything for me. I've already given up on that. However, I do want to mention a couple of things to you just to consider. And I have an ask today. My ask is that with LIBOR, the $17 million that was referred to earlier by the good legislators who brought this bill to you, is that Oregon join the class action suits to recover the money, as we do see in the newspapers and things like that. That, I think, would take care of the current crunch on PERS and change some of those things up. Now, I'm going on what's in the newspaper, and I never believe everything in the Oregonian, but I think that would make a difference. And I also want to state that I'm not against schools. The first time I came to testify in this building was during outcome-based education reform in 1995 with about 1,000 people that were here. So I am for the kids. However, the Department of Revenue puts out a very simple breakdown of what proportion of every dollar goes to what programs. And I have seen the variance on money for education be up to 60 cents of every dollar and down to about 55, and about 86% of that is for K through 12. So I'm thinking they're getting a pretty good section of what's going on there when you look at the allotments for public safety and things like that. And I just want to respond to what the legislators have said here. I do believe we need to act, and we need to act now, but I'm asking that the people responsible, which I know is not this committee, act on getting Oregon on the class action suits. Also, I do oppose passage of this particular bill. I think that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is excuse me, Carla Spence, and I have had the pleasure of serving the public as a case manager with the state for 20 years, and I've been involved with state government for over 30, and I'm not, I'm familiar with the attacks that have been launched against public employees over time. In 1995, when there was a ballot measure that sought to take away 6% of PERS passed, and we were in negotiations, I led a strike of public employees to protect our pension benefits. And I think it's sad when I hear people at this table, Representative Buckley, saying that they had to make a choice between breaking a promise to our seniors and our retirees or breaking a promise to our children. And I thought to myself, how can we justify breaking any promises? I think there are ways that we can solve the budget crisis that's going on in this building without breaking that promise to either group. And I have grandchildren in school. I care a lot about our educational system. But I also think that it is erroneous for us to sit here and hear testimony that says what happened on Wall Street didn't affect us here. Because before 2007, our PERS system was fully funded, and now it's not. And that's not your fault. It's not
public employee's fault. It is the fault of a system that failed, and systems that were not accountable to the people that we serve. So I think I'd like for you to go back to the drawing board. This is a problem, and I understand that there was a lot of thought that went into this proposal, and there's a lot more worse proposals out there. So of all the bad proposals, this is the best of the bad. But I do think that there's another way to do this, and that is to look at revenue streams and prioritizing getting rid of some of the really unconscionable tax breaks that we give to some folks, and look at our spending priorities. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Garrett, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name's Jay Thatcher. I'm an active teacher in Corvallis. I'm planning on retiring this spring after 25 years of working more or less faithfully for the same district. It'll be a modest retirement. I work part-time. I won't fall under any new COLA limitations after the first year of this proposal. They will start affecting me in my 70s and 80s, I believe. Is that whom the state wishes to take extra money from? I've been reflecting on the risks that you run by enacting this legislation. The 400 some million in savings is leveraged over many years of applying these cost of living limitations. If they're found not legal, what will the state, the municipalities, and the districts do to repay the retirement system for all the money they've saved in the first few years? The money stands to be taken from people on limited incomes who spend most of that allowance. This will suck that money right out of the Oregon economy, because most of us live in Oregon and will after we retire. That'll be a severe drain on the Oregon economy, more than you would from taxing wealthy individuals and large corporations. The risk of reducing the contributions of municipalities and districts is that they will return in 2 years, as they have every 2 years for over a decade, asking for still more money. These are another one of the broken promises. This stands to be a broken promise to public employees here. What will you do to find good quality public employees in the future? Thank you for your time. I'm certainly open to questions.
Thank you very much, all three of you, for your testimony. Thanks for being here. And next we'll call Keith Morgan, Glenn Harris, and Bob Clem. And then after we hear from them, the next three people on the list are Rob Martineau, Chuck Moffitt, and Tina Turner Moffitt. And I know one of you traveled from Klamath Falls, and we appreciate you coming from so far, so please go ahead.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, my name is Bob Clem. I started teaching in 1980. I taught junior high school art in Klamath Falls for about 22 years before I found that to be something I didn't want to do anymore. I didn't retire. I quit and moved on. I currently work as a campus public safety officer at Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls, and I'm very proud to do so. I'm very concerned about what I've seen since the beginning of my career, although my career was twofold as a teacher and now as a public safety officer, the continued attacks on PERS. And I go back to Representative Buckley's comments at the beginning of his testimony today that he was taught as a young man to keep your word. And we've talked about promises, and although we talked about, and other people have testified about promises, then suddenly there's this switch. Well, we've got these promises, but we've got to break one of them, so now we must figure out which one to break. I feel that it's much more a I think the solution is not which promise do we break, but how do we keep all the promises that we've made. And in order to do that, there are, I believe, ways that the tremendous amount of effort that's being spent talking about how to break this promise, if that same amount of effort were spent by attorneys, lobbyists, and our esteemed legislators in another direction, I believe the problem could be solved. There are revenue streams that I think are somewhat untapped that have been mentioned today. There are a tremendous amount of uncollected tax dollars that are on the books, taxes that have not been paid, that if you as legislators were simply to put some more concerted effort into collecting, that could fill part of the gap. I heard from Senator Whitsitt today that there's a significant amount of uncollected monies that are in the form of fines and even parking tickets that's available. And that could be turned into a revenue stream. I know that in the governor's budget around this, the whole question of whether or not what we're doing here today is legal or illegal, I know that in the governor's budget there's a line item set aside for court costs to fight the inevitable court cases should this bill be passed. That does not seem like a good use of my tax dollars either. So I thank you for taking time to listen to me today, and I do not envy you your task.
Thank you again for your service and for traveling so far to be with us today, and please go ahead.
I'm Glenn Harrison from Albany. Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Garrett and members of the committee. I'll give you a little bit of my background before I get into some other kinds of things. I was a teacher for 32 years in high school and community college math, and now I've been retired for almost 20 years. For 5 years I was on a school board, and for 9 years on a city budget committee, so I'm aware from the employer standpoint the need for fundings there too. But for 11 and a half years I had the privilege of being on the purse board. Five governor appointments over a period of time. We've talked about the unfunded liability in PERS. At some points and nearly every time there was an unfunded liability, it was because of stock market crashes of various kinds. In 1987, there was Black Monday, when the stock market dropped 20% in one day. The 2003 change in PERS was largely because of the 2001 Enron situation and 2002 WorldCom, when they both had serious problems. Fortunately, we did receive some money back out of the bankruptcy settlement of Enron, so the state did get some money back, and I'd like to see that continued on the current situations with the banking and housing crash, because there were several companies because of greed and other situations that we should be able to recover some of those funds, and also end some of the corporate tax breaks that Oregon has been very generous with companies in doing so. I do encourage you to pursue getting additional funding to help out schools, but this particular proposal and others that would be impacting current employees and those who are retired, it's not the best way to solve the situation that is currently before you.
Thank you for your testimony. And please go ahead.
Hi. Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Keith Morgan. For the record, I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 822. I am a spouse of a PERS Tier 1 employee, and I am a Senior Vice President of Investments at Umpqua Investments in Lake Oswego. I'd like to comment on some aspects of the proposed legislation that you likely have not and will not hear from others. We've all heard the old adage, those who fail to plan, plan to fail. I work with individuals to help them plan for retirement. As a matter of fact, I met today with a PERS member. The conundrum in her plan is the PERS income, the wild card, if you will. The unknown makes planning more dynamic and the outcome less predictable. Unfortunately, many people today are working hard, saving money, and hoping for the best. PERS members have made plans based on benefits made available to them when they were hired. There are four groups of people that would be affected by this legislation should it pass. The first group is PERS retirees. And by the way, when they retired, they made an irrevocable choice of what amount of income they needed for them or their spouse based on the choices that were available. They can't change that. Inflation is up, making their purchasing power less, and we're considering asking them to live on even less income. These are folks who are not likely able to re-enter the workforce to help make ends meet. They have worked for decades to create a lifestyle, and now that we're on hard economic times, we're pulling the rug out from under their life's work. It may be too late to adjust their financial plan. The second group of people are PERS working members. They've been planning toward retirement for years and look forward to enjoying their golden years in financial stability. Some have sacrificed better paying jobs in the private sector. They have given to the state's people a career of dedication and hard work. The choices they have at this point, besides leaving to work in the private sector, are as follows. They can work more years before they retire. They can save more money on the side. They can invest more aggressively on the side. Or they can plan to live on less income in retirement. Those are the four basic changes that can be made when a financial plan is put together. I ask the theoretical question, which of these would you personally want to have to consider? The third group are future PERS members, hirees, people that we would hire down the road. I'd like to think that the state of Oregon has a lot to offer new potential employees. Our economy is recovering nicely, and I'm getting close to running out of time, so those people, if you want to attract the best, you can't be pulling the rug out from under them. The last one is, okay, the very last thing is that these folks have all made choices. They've made a choice to take on a job, they've made a choice in retirement, and for us to go in now and say that we're going to make changes to the choices that you'd made in your life's work is just simply not fair. Back to the very beginning comment about doing what's right, if we all think about what our parents taught us, doing what's right is keeping that commitment to these folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next we'll go to Rob Martineau, Chuck Moffitt, and Tina Turner-Morfitt, if the three of you are here. And great. And then next we'll hear from David Bolton, Greg Monahan, and John LePink. Thanks for waiting so patiently. And great to see you. Please go ahead.
For the record, my name is Rob Martineau. I'm here today representing AFSCME, Local 189, City of Portland employees. And I want to thank this committee for affording me the opportunity to share my perspective on this. For the last 13 years, I've worked to provide safe, clean water to the residents of Portland and much of the greater metro area. When I took this job, I remember the old-timers who spoke of the challenges of doing this type of work for 30 years. But one thing they agreed on was that they've been able to provide for their families, livelihoods, and earn a stable retirement for their later years. Senate Bill 822 is illegal. It will not save money, and it's not acting in good faith. I'm a ditch digger. Underground construction is a demanding job. It happens in the rain, the mud, and on days like today, the beautiful Oregon sun. After 30 years in this line of work, myself and many of the people that I work with will be physically spent. There just will not be much left. When I started, they said 30 years, and you'll be able to retire and enjoy those later years. Now after 13, it appears I've only got 25 left to go. It never crossed my mind that this agreement was only good until the legislature decides they can no longer afford it, or the governor decides it's easier to cut my benefits than raise taxes or even reduce tax breaks on those earning many times what I do. I willingly pay my share, and now more than my share is being taken under the false dichotomy of schools versus supposed wealthy retirees who could afford it anyway. This year you spend millions of dollars to hold a one-day special session just to give a tax break to Nike so they would continue to provide jobs to Oregonians. I don't have a problem with this on its face, but I do have a problem with you cutting my retirement benefits to pay for a budget shortage because of tax breaks like this. Mr. Knight does not need to worry about his financial future, but I will. I don't believe 822 is legal and won't balance the budget. It will hurt hardworking families like mine and other retirees. Please don't take the benefits that we've all earned. And I oppose Senate Bill 822.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
For the record, my name is Tina Turner-Morfitt. I work for the Department of Corrections at the Coffee Creek facility at the Intake Center. I've worked for the Department of Corrections for 32 years, and I'm here representing Ask Me Local 2376. In my line of work, in prison, your word is your bond. I'm here to ask you to vote no on Senate Bill 822. I believe that the bill is immoral, and I think it's wrong, no matter how you examine it. I think you're trying to balance the budget on the backs of working families by cutting their retirement benefits. And my question is, why do we need to do that? Why do we need to pit the old against the young? From what I can tell, the legislature and the governor have decided to increase the budget for K through 12 education without first looking for new or increased revenue or trying to figure out how to pay for it. So it was decided the easiest place to find the money was to cut the benefit of thousands of Oregon retirees and to break a promise that was made to thousands of working families. The legislature has cut my agency's budget session after session. Our members and my co-workers are trapped in prison where we're understaffed and overcrowded, but we're still expected to bring down recidivism. We have had our wages frozen. We've been subjected to mud days, and now we pay for our benefits, our health care benefits, which get cut year after year. And now we feel like our retirement is being stolen. The courts have already ruled on these issues saying that they're illegal, but I guess we're going to have to go back to court again and see if they really meant it. By the time we get a ruling on this, we'll have to pay the retirees and any associated earning costs associated with the lawsuit and the legal action. We deserve better than this. We keep Oregon working. What you are proposing, again, is unfair to balance the budget on our backs. Just say no to stealing the future of hardworking Oregonians that provide the services that voters and taxpayers are demanding. I'm here to ask you to protect current retirees and future retirees. I'm here to ask you to demonstrate to Oregon citizens that your word is your bond.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Chuck Moffitt. I'm the president of the Oregon AFSCME Retirees Association, and I'm here today in opposition to Senate Bill 822. I worked for the City of Portland as an accountant for 22 years, and I retired in 2008 based on a promise made by my employer and the PERS system. I'm also a 40% disabled military veteran, and if it were not for that, I would not have been able to afford to retire. My annual income from PERS is approximately $15,000. My monthly PERS check is actually less than my wife and I's monthly health premium we pay to our former employer. I may actually fall into a category that will see little impact by this bill, but that is not the point. What you're proposing is immoral and wrong at every level. I am here today to represent all AFSCME retirees, some who make more than I do and many who make less. For example, one of our members who is gravely concerned over this outrageous attack on benefits is a 90-year-old who worked for the Multnomah County Animal Control for almost 20 years until he had to retire for health reasons. His benefit is $990 per month. He called terrified that you were going to cut his benefits. He said to us that he just did not know how he could get by if his benefits were cut. He is barely making ends meet now. Healthcare costs are rising, prescription drugs are increasing, and his retirement will not increase. He was literally in tears because of your proposals. And his fear is that he may not be able to get by. 20 years of faithful service deserves better than this. While many of us understand you have a budget problem, we do not think slashing the benefits of retired people is the answer. You have as much of a revenue problem as you do a spending problem. This is not a problem that should be solved on the backs of PERS retirees. You need to eliminate many tax breaks, raise revenue on Oregon's richest citizens, and leave retirees alone. We did what you asked. We came to work every day just like you wanted. Now give us the retirement benefit we earned. There are certainly adjustments that need to be made to PERS. No one questions that. For example, ensure that only income that derives from public funds is included in PERS. Don't allow individuals to jack up their PERS compensation by including endorsement deals or funds from private foundations. These are reforms that we can all agree on. Just to go off script for 1 minute, I have 4 children in the public school system right now. My children went through the public school system, as did I. And I want to see children educated as much as everyone else. But this is not a zero-sum game. This doesn't have to be one wins, one loses. If you can find revenue, you can raise everyone's necessary funds. Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Thank you for doing the hard jobs that you do every day. And the next witnesses will be Greg Monahan, John Lepink, and David Bolton. The three of you would like to come forward, and then we will hear from Everest Morrow, Clarence Pugh, and Jay Thatcher. Thank you three for waiting so patiently, and please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. I'm Greg Monahan, representing the Association of Oregon Faculties. I'm also an actual real PERS retiree. 26 years ago, I came to teach history at what was then Eastern Oregon State College in La Grande. Some of you know where that is. Even though the state did not offer the best in faculty salaries, it still doesn't, it did promise a pretty good retirement system, including the promise of modest cost of living adjustments. Unfortunately, now the state, through Senate Bill 822, wants to back out on that promise. Bizarrely, it has targeted the people who have served it most loyally, its own long-term employees. This committee now proposes to report out a bill which we firmly believe is illegal, which we know is unfair. Now, I've been in Oregon a long time, and I've come to know a lot of legislators, and I like you. I do. You're ethical people. You want to do ethical things. You're feeling pain at doing this. This is the kind of pain that you should pay attention to. It means it's a bad thing. Right? I would ask you not to do this. Stand up and support the people who have devoted their professional lives to this great state and its people. You've heard a lot of good alternatives today. Choose one. Find another path. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenblum, member of the committee, my name is John Lepink. I'm a retired from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. After 18 years, I retired at 66. My retirement is somewhere around $19,000 a year after that time of work. I want to share my disappointment with the Senate Bill 288, or 822, the attack on PERS and COLA. However, it is more important for me to share a story of a sister member of mine, Victoria Pratt, who's not able to be here today because of health problems. I will submit a handwritten or a written testimony that I want to paraphrase what she says today for in interest of time. Victoria retired in 1999 after 27 years as a senior investigator for the Bureau of Labor and Industry. Because of continued attacks on PERS, she decided to put her investment portion in Wall Street. So part of her investment was in Wall Street, which collapsed in 2000. She had to go back to work on special assignments until 2009, and she did fairly well up to that time. In 2009, she was diagnosed with cancer. Since that time, she has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and doesn't expect to live too much longer. But because of that cancer, she has not been able to make her medical payments. She's not been able to make her house payments. And if there's any continued cut in COLAs, she'll even be able to make less of those payments because of the COLA cuts. So what she says here in the last paragraph is that it's pretty humiliating to live my life after devoting all of my energies to work for the state and continuing to do what was right and still be looked at in such a light that you're going to cut my last little bit of money that I get. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, thank you for hearing some testimony on this issue. And my own senator, Senator Devlin, who I love dearly, but I can't say I love this newest idea of yours. And let me tell you why I don't like your idea of Senate Bill 822. I've actually been elected bargaining representative, and I'm president of a local 440 for SEIU. And I was there and actually observed when my employer came to me and said, listen, we'd really like to have some cash, but our idea is that could we throw some more money into your retirement fund, because that would be cheaper for us. We wouldn't have to pay you the cash right now. And a lot of us said, okay, well, we believe in retirement security, so is that a win-win? Okay, let's write it up in the contract. And it's been in the contract. This is not a new idea. It's been in the contract for over 20 years. So the
and Dave, I don't want to interrupt you, but yes. Our staff seems to think that you haven't said your name for the record.
Oh, I haven't. Excuse me. Dave Bolton, president of Local 440 SEIU. That's DCBS that some of you might be familiar with. And our employees over at DCBS wanted to tell you that the people that I represent that have advanced degrees like CPA, MBA, JD, CLU, CHFC, HIA, you know, they actually work in rate regulation, do the exchange stuff, we don't think that we're overpaid. And we've invited Representative Richardson several times to our monthly meeting to explain how we're overpaid, but we haven't seen him yet, but we'd love to see him, and we treat him fairly. But this is the whole point, is that the state employees have actually sacrificed. We've helped the state. The state came to us and they said, hey, can you skip your state step increases? Okay, if that helps you through this period. Can you do unpaid furlough days? Okay, we'll help out there. Can you pay for more for your health insurance? Okay. Now the next proposal is, hey, let's take some of your promised PERS benefits away from you. I mean, how long are you going to balance the state budget problems of the schools on the back of the state employees? I can tell you, as chair of the food drive, it's getting harder and harder to get state employees to get into this. And let's be clear, Measure 5 and equalization and the physical gimmick of pension obligation bonds, that's the real reason why we don't have money for the kids. When do we hear about that? Why is it always the state employees in my pension plan? My former employer, I've invested in two pension plans. None of them have written to me and saying, Dave, the economy's bad. We want to pull back some of your pension money. We'd like to hire more employees. We'd like to build a new factory. We'd like to get a corporate Learjet. No, that's because federal law prohibits that under ERISA. And the state should follow the same fiduciary standard. Thank you.
Thank you all three for your testimony. And I think I called somebody that had already testified. So our next three people will be Ephraim Morrow, Clarence Pugh, and then Trish Stevens. Unless there are two Jay Thatchers, I think we already heard from Jay Thatcher. And then next after them will be Margie Lowe, Lisa Dixon, and Mike Powers. Thank you very much for waiting so patiently, and please tell us who you are and go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, I'm Everett Morrow, and both my husband and I are PERS recipients. I retired in June 2011 after 30 years as a classified employee for the Estacada School District with a final hourly wage of $14.61 an hour. Due to budget cutbacks, I did not work a 40-hour week or a full school year. Due to similar limitations throughout my working years, my future retirement fund was subsequently reduced and was further reduced by 2003 legislation that cut my expected retirement by one-third. Then they continued to devastate my retirement fund by putting my money into the IAP account instead of my PERS. When I retired, I used those IAP monies to pay for the $1,100 a month health insurance for my son and myself until he aged out at 26. Now he has no insurance. Even under those circumstances, I was prepared to live on my PERS retirement of $1,372 after taxes each month. I pay $600 now for my health insurance. I buy groceries, gas, shop for other necessities each month. My husband of 40-plus years, who was also a PERS recipient, was a school employee for 14 years but had to leave for a better-paying job in order to support our family, because even with both of us working, we qualified for food stamps and free lunch. He's currently paying back the PERS system each month. His other retirement plan was a 401k, which suffered from the financial crisis, and I now make more money than he does. Together, we can make our way financially, but changing both of our PERS retirement funds would put a serious crimp in our budget for the future. We've never had a fancy lifestyle. We worked hard to pay off our mortgage. We pay our taxes. We donate to charitable causes. We did everything we were supposed to do. I kept the promises I made. The media portrays PERS recipients as solely responsible for the school funding crisis in Oregon, but I take deep exception to that. I didn't cause the financial crisis or collapse on Wall Street. I am not greedy. I fought to keep my job and the jobs of others in Estacada when school district officials wanted to contract out our jobs. It wasn't for the fabulous wages. It was because of my commitment to the students, the families, and the community who needed education delivered by dedicated employees and people who needed jobs and the community that needed those jobs and the money they provided. I didn't ask for tax breaks. I don't need special incentives or benefits to live here in Oregon. I was promised a decent retirement for my commitment and in exchange for wage and benefit concessions demanded by my employer and the legislature. Please stop trying to placate the businesses and the people who already have the greater wealth and who protect the people who have worked hard and earned their retirements. So will you now please look me in the eye and tell me that this is somehow my fault and I should now pay back for the lack of funding for schools? With all due respect, your conciliatory words about shared sacrifice mean nothing if you lack the courage and the character to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
And I have the longer version.
Great. We'll look forward to
that. And if I may,
that.
I'd like to give this one for a second.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Clarence Pugh. I live in Salem. The state of Oregon used to allow PERS retirees to not pay income taxes on their retirement. About 1991, when that was changed, the state negotiated an increase in our retirement salaries to mitigate the cost of retirees of the newly added taxes. This was done because it has always been understood that the vast number of public employees were underpaid and retirements were low. It applied to retirees who live in Oregon and to those who moved to other states. Now Senate Bill 822 wants to take back the payments to retirees who live elsewhere than Oregon, thus reducing their negotiated and promised retirement income. This, while those retirements who live out of state don't even know it is going to happen and will not have a voice or a vote in the matter. When I began teaching in 1965, my first year's pay was $5,400 a year. On that base, it didn't accrue to a hefty amount. Now, as we are older, my wife and I need to move closer to our children who live out of state. And we want to do this while we can still make the decision for ourselves. Why should we suffer because we have gotten older? When is a promise a promise? 2 months ago, the legislature gave a promise to Nike to not change their taxing system. Nike said they were planning a new development that would create a whole bunch of $100,000 a year jobs. And they said if they didn't get this tax guarantee, they would find somewhere else to go. I think Nike and Phil Knight expect the state to keep its word, and it's hard for me to believe that any future legislature will go back on the word given to this business this year. So in this case, a promise seems to be a promise. Who is paying for Nike's development in those $100,000 jobs? The citizens of Oregon are, and among them are we retirees. Retirees like me, who never came close to a $100,000 a year salary, but did the work of the state, contributed our citizenship, contributed to the economy, contributed to the social and intellectual fabric, and made Oregon a more livable place. So is a promise made to retirees a promise kept, or is it not? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Trish Stevens. I'm a Tier 2 PERS member. I've worked in the Willamina School District for over 15 years. I spend my days working with special needs students at the elementary school. This economic crisis that we've all been living through was not caused by myself or any of the other employees at Willamina School District. It was caused by the irresponsible banks who abused the system. My family, like a lot of other Oregon families, has suffered during this crisis. As a lumber mill worker, my husband has been laid off for 2.5 out of the last 4 years. Excuse me. I'm a classified school employee. My wages have been frozen. I have taken day cuts. My wages have been rolled back to 1994 levels. As a family, we've been forced to use all of our savings. Sell our home. Our newer cars. Excuse me, the things that we worked hard for as a family. Excuse me. We have both... With both of us losing wages, we went from a comfortable middle-class income to applying for food stamps. Not something I thought we'd ever do as a family. I made the decision long ago to work for the school district because of the security, knowing I was building my retirement savings and literally banking on my family's future. Currently, my expected PERS benefit at age 65 is less than $750 a month. Any further cuts to the PERS system would put my husband and myself at risk at a time in our lives when I hope to be enjoying my future grandchildren. Not worrying about how we're going to afford housing, food, or increased medical costs. I'm worried for my family, I'm worried for my future, and I'm worried for my retirement. Please don't punish my family and I and thousands of other families like us because we have revenue problems. Because you have revenue problems. We all have revenue. How much more can you ask us to give? As an Oregon taxpayer and a parent, I ask you to please look at our broken system and find revenue needed to fund education and other critical programs. This isn't fair. This is not a, sorry, that's a fair and legal way. We need to find a fair and legal way to solve these problems. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. And I know it's not easy to get up here and tell personal stories, but I think it's extremely important that people know that the people affected by this bill are not averages or numbers, but real people.
Thank you.
Lives.
Sorry.
Thank you both. I wanted to mention, before we call the next panel, that Representative Garrett and Representative Hicks both would have been here, but they're serving currently on another committee that also just started an evening meeting, and so they had to leave for that. And so now Representative Hoyle has stepped in as the vice chair of the committee. And the next three people that we're going to hear from are Margie Lowe, Lisa Dixon, and Mike Powers, if the three of you would like to come forward. And then after that, I think we're getting close to the end of our list. I see Dave Reinhard and Jay Osborne. Please go ahead and thank you for waiting so patiently.
Hi. For the record, my name is Margie Lowe, and I didn't ever think I would be back on this side of the dais. I have had the honor of presenting to legislative committees for 3.5 decades, working with many of you and many honorable projects and issues, and so I appreciate the difficulty of your task. I just want to share with you the reason why I'm here today as a retiree instead of as a public policy person that I've had a lifelong passion to do for the benefit of the state of Oregon. It's not easy being in that kind of role. I can certainly understand the conundrum that you all find yourselves in. But, you know, I also found it to be very difficult back in 2003 when I was in my late 40s and surrounded by people who were retiring left and right. I was working in the Department of Human Services at the time, and you couldn't schedule a meeting in that building because everyone was bailing out. They were all booked for retirement parties to say farewell to all of my coworkers. And I thought, who would have thought in my late 40s I would have wished I was older than I was? But I certainly felt that way. Because at that time, it was obvious that I was going to lose 30 to 40% of the retirement benefits that I had come to understand that I would earn. And I'd actually served as the PERS budget analyst during part of my tenure at Budget Management Division. So I really did understand what the system was. And, you know, because of what I'd heard from other colleagues in years before, I had said, you know, I don't really need to do the advance savings because I know that it's a stable retirement system. I'm going to be able to count on that. And the decisions had been made by the court that it was a contract right. And so I thought what the court had said was something that a person could actually rely on. And then in 2003, decisions were made otherwise, and I was swept up in a situation where it was obvious that it was going to be a substantial loss. Rather than being just angry about that, I said, okay, I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to earn that second degree that I always promised myself. I'm going to find new ways in which to serve the citizens of Oregon. And I did. I moved into the education policy realm. I've studied a lot of what those issues are and worked with many of you in that realm. But when I saw the governor's speech in draft form to the Oregon School Boards Association, I said, you know, I thought I would someday be able to earn back what had been promised by just working long enough to be able to get back to that point. And I'm like, you know, I felt like that guy with that rock trying to push it up the hill. And every time he gets a little ways ahead, he rolls back and just plows over the top of him. There I was, and I just said, you know, I give up. And I really worry about what else is being lost from other people who gave up. In 2003, the best calculus teacher at Sprague High School retired. I have one daughter who's an engineer and another one who would have made a heck of an engineer. But because she had a calculator teacher who wasn't that good, she said the last time she's going to take calculus was that year, her senior year. What else have we lost? Because other people say, enough, I can't take it anymore.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and please go ahead.
Okay. My name is Lisa Dixon, and I work for DCBS, Insurance Division. And first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I know in other countries, people can't speak publicly, so I think we're blessed for that. Our PERS is a contract, and it's a protection for us, and also for our legislators as well, because they in turn have PERS, correct? Or a federal version of it. When I started at the state, as someone said earlier, I believe that we had a deal. You know, I'll show up for 40 hours, maybe more, you know, do a good job, train people, help people, you know, move the citizens of the state of Oregon in the direction that they need to go. And, you know, I expected the state in return to honor their end of the deal as well. I'm an 17, which is basically support office worker, and I make about a quarter of your incomes, actually, if you do the numbers. There's well-traveled proof that state workers were below wage compared to private sector, and we do go in eyes open with that. I see in the newspapers where people say, well, if state workers wanted to get a better job, they could do that. Well, alrighty then. And it's getting attacked every 2 years. It seems like, as with other funds that are quite large, that seems to be a place to go to get dollars to balance the budget. And frankly, the fight every 2 years, I agree, sometimes is exhausting, as you all know as well. Our legislators are intelligent as well and educated people, or you wouldn't be sitting in front of us leading the state of Oregon. But please don't use our retirement as a tool to balance the budget. This bill suggests also that you care more about the wealthy and the corporation than your people, and I really hope that that's not the case for our legislators. Interestingly, how many dollars are sitting in this room right now possibly debating something that is not going to go anywhere, and that is tragic, tragic amount of money, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, Chair Garrett is no longer here at the moment, members of the committee, my name is Mike Powers, and I'm here as a SEIU member and a private citizen. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. My family might be a typical future PERS family. Our son is in the Salem-Keizer public school system. And so we personally experienced the crowded classrooms and the reduced school days and the lack of resources in our schools. My wife serves as faculty at Chemeketa Community College. So we understand the need and challenge of education funding. And so we get it. I understand the need for more education funding. Our family wants better education funding for our son, for my wife's students, and for all Oregonians. But I'm bothered that the governor, much of the media, and many in this legislature have defined this challenge as PERS versus public education. It's a false choice and a divisive choice. As Representative Buckley noted, future and current PERS recipients had no role in the 2008 stock market crash and following Great Recession. Yet I'm unaware of any meaningful actions that PERS, Governor Kitzhaber, or this legislative body have taken to hold accountable the too-big-to-fail banks and investment managers whose actions put all of us at risk. I'm asking you that you consider accountability and fairness. Hold the big banks and investment managers accountable for the hole in PERS. Share the education funding responsibility fairly among all Oregonians who live and work here, not just from the retirements of current and future public employees. Look for other responsible ways to capture efficiencies and cost savings. I ask that you strongly consider and support at least some of these opportunities. Seriously rein in Oregon's $32 billion in tax expenditures. Ensure that surviving tax expenditures benefit Oregon's working families. Do not allow the buying and selling of tax expenditures between companies. Direct the Oregon Department of direct the Oregon Department of Revenue to go after tax dodgers and give the department the resources to do it. Cap income tax deductions
and mortgage tax deductions. And finally, consider making reasonable and legal challenges to changes to PERS that do not penalize Oregon seniors and working families. I appreciate your time and attention, and please seek appropriate accountability. Please don't penalize our seniors and hardworking Oregonians, and please seek a better way. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you all three for your testimony. And I just wanted to let people in the audience know that we do have, I think, about seven more people to testify, and we will keep going until we've heard from everybody. So next, we'll call Dave Reinhardt, Jay Osborne, and Roberta Yambasu, if the three of you would like to come forward. And after them, we have four more people, and they're Eileen Wendy, Jan Peterson, Mark Reynolds. I guess that's it, actually, unless there are two Mark Reynolds, which is possible. Mary. Oh, Mary. Okay, Mary and Mark Reynolds. Please go ahead.
Hi.
And thanks for waiting so patiently.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Dave Reinhardt, representing the Oregon PERS Retirees Incorporated, about 6,000 members, and as a result of your actions, especially this week, growing. You'll hear from the president of our organization in a little bit, but I just wanted to make a few points, and I realize the hour's late, and you've heard a lot about this already. I used to be a PERS reformer in my former life at the Oregonian as a columnist, and starting in the mid-90s, and then on into the early 2000s. And much of that reform was done thanks in part to some folks in this room here. It was, I think, successful in writing a system that was at the time woefully out of whack and really lavish. I'm fairly proud of the positions I took at that time. Some of them were vindicated in the courts, not all of them. What you were confronting at that time was that the PERS board had failed. It had not acted responsibly. The legislature, I think, got around to this far too late. But that's in the past, and the courts determined that there were contractual obligations that the PERS recipients and the public employees of this state enjoyed. And here we are today. You are in a terrible position that is really the result of the irresponsibility of old legislators. But, and this is really important to me, a deal was made with these folks, a deal that was vindicated in the courts. Contracts and the rule of law were vindicated in these cases. Aside from the contractual and constitutional issues at play here, you also have a basic question of fairness. These folks, our retirees and the Oregon public employees, current, were given a set of assumptions when they were hired and when they retired. And now you're going to take this away from them. They made one of the hardest decisions, the most significant decisions in one's lifetime. And I do think it is just unfair to backtrack on that. And I realize this policy before us is just a little backtracking, but in principle, it's undercutting the contract right. And with that, I'll end my spiel and turn it over to Jay Osborne, and thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in this committee, Chair Rosenbaum and the committee members. As Dave mentioned, I'm the Oregon PERS Retiree Board Chair. OPRI represents, from my perspective, all PERS retirees and future retirees, because we're we have their interest at heart. I am also a member of the Retired Oregon School Employees, we call it ROSE, which is the retiree arm of Oregon School Employees Association. OPRE ROSE and OSEA are opposed to any reductions in PERS retirees' benefits, as am I, personally. We hold that these proposals are unfair and illegal. If passed, they will cost taxpayers millions of dollars in legal fees. According to statistics posted on the PERS by the numbers, there are 113,464 current PERS retirees and beneficiaries. This number excludes folks who took the lump sum option. There are a total of 346,386 inactive, and retirees in the PERS system, all of whom will be adversely affected in some way by these proposed reductions in their promised contractual benefits. Judging from the huge quantity of letters OPRE has received lately, PERS retirees will not take this assault lying down. Why? Because it's not fair. It's illegal, and it will create a major hardship for many folks. Please allow me a moment to tell you about my situation as an example of how the COLA cap would adversely affect my wife's and my finances. I retired just 1 month shy of turning 66 years of age after working for North Clackamas School District for nearly 30 years. I'm a Tier 1 retiree who retired on Money Match. My wife is also a PERS retiree. She worked for Clackamas Community College for about 15 years, and she also retired on Money Match. She retired about 10 years ago. Shortly after retiring, she was awarded Social Security benefits, disability, because she has numerous health issues. Taken together, our total PERS retirement benefit is pretty modest at $3,700 a month. Before we retired, our combined income was nearly $80,000 a year. I just want to give you figures instead of just saying, you know. In addition to our medical insurance premiums, we were paid by our representative employers. The COLA cap would affect, I'm going to go fast here, our income and as much as my benefit after committing 30 years to my employer exceeds the proposed COLA cap, $20,000 COLA cap. Our medical deductions this year were $8,950, up from $7,770 last year, which is more than a $1,000 increase. The point being is that this would diminish our income, while all the while our expenses are going up, as are those of many retirees. I'm going to just let it go here because I don't want to, you know, take somebody else's time, but please read the rest of my testimony.
We will. Thank you very much. And please go ahead.
My name is Roberta Yambasu. I am a public school employee who retired after teaching for 30 plus years, taught mostly in Portland. I have grandchildren who are now in school. At least one of them is now in school. And as a PERS employee, I can tell you, I sacrificed already. I sacrificed when they froze my wages. I sacrificed when I worked 10 days for free and was promised I would never have to take another cut like that. I sacrificed when I paid my own health benefits, at least parts of them. And I sacrificed in 2003 when the changes then cut what I was expected to receive by 25%. I've sacrificed. I don't need to sacrifice again. Frankly, I look at the Senate bill, which has no sunset, so it's not just meant to fix the problem now, has no sunset in it, and I see it as a thinly veiled attack on PERS. You want to reform PERS, well then let's state that you're going to reform PERS. And perhaps it needs to be reformed. I don't necessarily agree with that, but there are ways to get money. There are the tax breaks people have mentioned. There's a rainy day fund. There's a continuation of higher taxes for people in higher tax brackets and corporations. Why don't we do some of those and not attack PERS once more and ask once more for public employees who do not receive the highest wages in the world to sacrifice again? That's all I have to say.
Thank you, all three, for your testimony. And next, we have four remaining on the list, so I'll call them all four. Maybe we can pull up an additional chair. And that's Eileen Wendy, Dan Peterson, Mark Reynolds, and Mary Reynolds. And if we missed anybody, this is everybody we have signed up. So, good evening. And it was afternoon when we started, so thank you very much for hanging in here. We have been really listening very carefully, and we're looking forward to hearing from you, too. So please, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Eileen Wendy. I'm a retired teacher. And I'd like to thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, and Chair Hoyle, for your patience and the patience of all the committee. I understand your commitment, and the reason I'm choosing to take your time is because I was at a meeting on Monday, and I was hearing a presentation on the 822, and I raised my hand, and I told them my story, and the response was, don't take this personally. It's not meant to be personal. And I thought, wow. It is personal because as a family, I have three children who went through Portland Public Schools. We made our decisions all along the way. I didn't start out like the teacher from Roseburg, my second year of teaching, but 10 years from retirement, I went to the PERS meetings, the district had meetings. If anyone, our financial company had meetings, we went to the meetings. We decided our priority was to pay for our children's college educations. We didn't give them a car. We didn't give them a fancy boat. We didn't have an RV, but they had their college educations paid for so they could graduate without a debt. So when I came to time for me to retire, I had to make some financial decisions. My husband worked for PGE Enron, so we already had, despite years of sound financial planning, doing everything you would have me do. Maximize your 401B, maximize your 403, get this, get that. We did it, but things happened beyond our control. We sold our home, we raised our family, and after I retired and moved to another part of town where the taxes were lower. Am I supposed to call my kids and ask them to start paying back their college fund at 2% a year? Was that part of the plan? So I'm feeling like it's not fair. It's probably not legal, but I'm asking you, is it ethical? Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jan Peterson, and I'm a retired PPS teacher, and this is a first for me, so bear with me. I want to put a face to a Tier 1 2011 retiree. A full formula plus annuity was my best payout. Money match wasn't even an option because it just didn't reach what this would do. I retired after 30 years in a behavior classroom with 53% of my salary. 53%, folks. You want to talk about your 75? I'd love to be a 75. I'm a 53. So during the course of my 30 years of teaching, my salary has been frozen. Like Bobby, I've worked for 10 days without pay. Not a furlough. I went to school every day and taught those kids because they weren't going to get it if we didn't do it. So I've taken benefits over salary increases. All of these things impacted my PERS payout because that was my salary that I was giving up. PERS reforms will not solve our funding crisis if and when all Oregon citizens choose to pay for a quality education model. That is when our crisis will be solved. We have a budget problem, not a PERS problem. For 30 years, we've had these problems. It's never been resolved. It needs to get resolved and not on our backs.
The quality of the teacher directly impacts the quality of our children's education. And at what point do our brightest stop entering to the teaching profession because they can no longer afford to? I have a niece who's brilliant. I begged her not to go into teaching because she's going to have to sacrifice so much. And she is that tier three, that little IAP account that maybe might get 40%. She understands that she's going to get much of nothing. And I feel that after the 10 years when her education debt is forgiven, then I think she'll go on to another career. So the last thing I want to say is I've already had my retirement benefits reduced from what was promised when I started teaching. Don't reduce my benefits any further, please. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your testimony and being so patient. And I called Mark Reynolds and Mary Reynolds, but I think they may have had to leave. I don't see them in the room. And so that actually completes everybody that we had signed up to testify tonight. Is there anyone else here who didn't get to testify? Okay, well, thank you very much to the members of the House Rules Committee and the members of the Senate Rules Committee and to the two presiding officers and Senator Devlin, who joined us again after his testimony. And with nothing further to come before us, the Senate Rules Committee is adjourned and the House Rules
Committee adjourned.